Good morning. I'm Donald Young, Chair of the San Francisco Bay Water Board, and I want to welcome you to today's board meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board for the San Francisco Bay Region. Happy Wednesday. Our meetings are hybrid and recorded, so in addition to in-person participants here in the auditorium, we may also receive public comments through our Zoom meeting platform. You can also view this meeting live and listen to recordings of previous meetings through our website on the Regional Board page. If you are not physically present and intend to comment today, you need to be in the Zoom meeting space rather than watching via the live webcast. If you have not received a link for the Zoom meeting, you can visit our website and register through the link on the agenda. After you register, you will receive a Zoom login link with access to the meeting. If you are in person and wish to speak, you may also register online or with assistance from our team at the registration table just outside the auditorium. Your registration is not required, but helps us to ensure your voice is heard at the appropriate time. For those in the Zoom meeting, you will be muted until it is your turn to speak. Our staff will then promote you. Please remember to accept the promotion to panelists and to unmute yourself so we can hear you. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking any questions they may have, you will be placed back on mute. For those in the room waiting to speak, you'll be called by name if you have registered or will be invited to speak after the registered parties. Please come down to the podium so then we can see you best and hear you. All speakers will be given 3 minutes for commentary. Please state your name and your affiliate organization if applicable when called upon. So thank you for joining us today. We look forward to a good meeting. I would now like to ask Julie Haas, our clerk for today's board meeting, to call the roll.
Good morning. Board Member Ransom.
Here.
Board Member Gunther.
Here.
Board Member Batty.
Here.
Board Member Kissinger.
Here.
Vice Chair Hacker is absent, and Chair Young.
Present. Thank you. We have a quorum physically present for today's meeting. Welcome, everyone. Now we open the public forum. I would now like to open that to the public forum. I'd like to remind everyone that the public forum is not for items that are on the agenda today. You can speak on those items at the appropriate time, nor for items that are a pending or impending matter, meaning they are about to come up on our agenda in the next few months. Please consult our board clerk, Julie Haas, who is seated here in the front of the auditorium, if you have any questions. I will now call on each of our public speakers who have registered to speak under the public forum portion of the meeting. If you are remote and have not been called, please raise your virtual hand on the Zoom platform by clicking on the reactions icon on your screen and then on the raised hand icon. That way we will know you are waiting to speak. Again, each speaker is allowed 3 minutes and will be timed and notified via the online timer visible on the screen. Thank you for your understanding, your participation. With that, Julie, do we have any online registrations for the public forum?
No online, but Dr. Dan Marsh is here in the room and would like to speak.
Sounds good. Mr. Marsh? Thank you, sir. We'll start the 3 minute timer. There's a button near the word Boya.
Oh, sorry. No. Sorry. Good morning. I'm Dan Marsh. As CEO of High Ground Solutions, I'm here to raise an issue about cross-boundary impacts among neighboring projects within the SF Bay region. High Ground Solutions works with policymakers and their staff to develop long-term viable plans for addressing permanent sea level rise. Our core concern is stranded assets, capital-intensive infrastructure such as seawalls, pump stations, and treatment facilities that get built and relicensed to one sea level horizon, then fail or become inoperable before the designed useful life because adjacent or dependent systems have been planned to a different but commonly held horizon or sea level continues. Unfortunately, this is exactly what I see developing on the SR 37 corridor. I raised these issues during a public comment period at the SR 37 Resilience Committee meeting on May 7th, 2026. In those remarks, I noted that the near-term SR 37 Tole Creek Bridge improvement has been designed to accommodate a sea level rise to the 2046 horizon combined with a 100-year flood event. Per the project's own engineering data, expected water levels were technically consistent in all regards. The problem appears when you consider what happens to adjacent infrastructure at that same water level. For Vallejo, 40% of the contaminated sites become vulnerable to groundwater intrusion, and the treatment facility's failure will make some areas of the city uninhabitable. Because your board holds jurisdiction over both sides of this issue, you're uniquely positioned to ensure that the design basis applied to one permitted project does not create foreseeable failures in neighboring projects. The purpose of this testimony is not to ask you to stop or reverse SR 37 improvement project. Instead, I'm asking you to exercise your authority to require that the cumulative interaction between the highway's design flood event and the Vallejo flood wastewater treatment plant's flood vulnerability be explicitly analyzed and addressed. High Ground Solutions is prepared to provide your board and staff with technical analyses supporting these findings and to work constructively with you and any impacted agencies and staff to find a coordinated solution. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Do we have any questions? None.
Okay.
Thank you for your time. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to speak today? Seeing none, I will close the public comments section, and we will move into our next section, which is part three, the minutes of April 8th, the board meeting. We're going to review the board meeting minutes from our April board meeting, including in our packets and posted online are the draft minutes from the April 8th, 2026 board meeting. Are there any edits or revisions to those minutes? I'm seeing none. I'd like to ask for a motion and a second to adopt the April board meeting minutes.
I'll make a motion to approve.
Second.
Motion by Board Member Batty, seconded by Board Member Ransom. Julie, can we have a roll call vote?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Batty.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
And Chair Young.
Aye. The motion passes. And our next one, we do have another set of meeting minutes to push through here. We're going to review the board meeting minutes from our May board meeting. May was an educational field tour of the China Basin Mission Bay area to observe various implementations of green stormwater infrastructure. Included in our board packets and posted online are the draft meeting minutes from May 13th, 2026 board meeting. Are there any edits or revisions? Seeing none, I would like to ask for a motion and a second to adopt the May board meeting minutes.
So moved.
Second.
That is a motion by Board Member Batty and a second by Board. That was Andy. Sorry.
Got
Julie,
it.
Can we have a roll call vote, please?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Batty.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
And Chair Young.
Aye. The motion passes. Thank you very much. And we'll move straight into our next section here, which is number four, Chair, Board Members, and Executive Officers Reports. First, we would like to welcome Sean McGuire, our State Water Board Liaison for our region. Sean, welcome. The floor is yours if you're online.
I am online. Good morning, Chair Young and board members. Good to see you as always. And as always, I think I always start saying there's a lot going on at the Water Board. That's always true. And so because of that, it's always a challenge as I'm thinking about all of the different areas that the State Water Board has purview over: drinking water, water rights, allocation, funding of different water infrastructure projects and water quality. It's always a challenge to winnow down the list of things that I think are most relevant to your board and the work that you're doing. And it occurred to me that we have a lot of reporting that happens amongst our boards. And for example, it was good to see you last month at the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting. It was great to see San Francisco Bay Regional Board's involvement and participation in that. Thank you for being there. And Hopefully that you found that informative and helpful and got a lot of good information about work that is happening at the State Board and also hearing from the other regions as well. We're doing a lot of very important work around the state to protect and improve water quality, and I commend you for your work and also everything that's happening amongst the regional boards. And on that note, just in terms of reporting and where to find information, I wanted to offer an opportunity for you to check out the State Board's Executive Director's Report. That report is updated every month and posted on the website, and I can provide a link to your executive officer later if you're interested. But there's a lot of information in that report about all the different programs that we have, what's going on, and importantly, there's a table that's linked on statewide policies and permits. And that goes over all of the statewide water quality policies that are in some level of development and provides updates on those. And so I think rather than read that list to you, I just wanted to provide that reference for you and just with an offer that I'm always willing to come in and talk about any of the policies and permits that we're working on at the state that are of interest to you. So please, if you get a chance, take a look at that, and happy to flag anything and follow up in a future liaison report update on those items. So I just wanted to provide that. There's no shortage of information out there that's available to you and to the public. And so we have a lot of resources. And so the only, just a couple of areas I wanted to flag in particular and highlight for you. I know at the Water Quality Coordinating Committee last month, you heard an update on our irrigated lands regulatory program expert panel process that we've had underway to consider appropriate means to develop regulatory targets or limits for nitrate pollution to groundwater in our irrigated lands across the state. I believe you heard at that update was that the expert panel's been doing a lot of work over the last several months, and their most recent update is that they adopted their final report last week on Friday. So very pleased that that process has come to a conclusion, and they're going to be presenting their report to the State Water Board on Tuesday of next week at our board meeting. So if you're interested in the irrigated lands process, where that may be heading, what the expert panel found, what the conclusions were and recommendations in their final report, I encourage you to listen to and participate in that the board meeting information item next week. I will be there and excited to hear what the expert panel has to say about their work. There's a lot to come in that area, a lot to happen, and we're going to be carefully considering that report in our as we move forward with our process. Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, I apologize. No, that's correct. Sorry, we have a lot. We have a lot of items on our agendas coming up, and I wanted to make sure that I'm giving you the right dates. So the other item I wanted to flag is next week also, we have an update on our development of a statewide strategy for constituents of emerging concern. I know that your region has done a lot and continues to do a lot when it comes to CECs as it relates to PFAS and CECs generally. Our Division of Water Quality team has been working on development of a statewide strategy to better get our arms wrapped around CECs before they become larger problems than we're able to manage. And so they're going to be providing an update on that strategy and also some focus updates on work that's happening as it relates to PFAS and 6-PPD quinone, which is a tire product, byproduct that is particularly sensitive and toxic to coho salmon and has affected them, particularly in the North Coast area when it gets into waterways. And so we're going to be hearing from our staff and also Caltrans and DTSC as to work that's happening in that space. So very interested to hear the updates there. And also, importantly, how we're continuing to look at CECs in our environment and recognizing that as we're advancing water reuse as well and looking at indirect, direct potable reuse projects, that connection with contaminants in our ecosystem and in our aquatic environment becomes more and more interrelated with drinking water risks and challenges. And so continuing to try and bridge that gap in the work that's happening is an area that I'm going to be focusing on as we go forward. So those are the areas I wanted to highlight for you. And as always, happy to take any questions or thoughts that you have. Thanks.
Thank you, Sean. We appreciate that. Is there any questions for Sean? All right, seeing none, we'll move forward to our next, which are our board member updates. I'll just start going to the right. Board Member Batty.
Yes, I have just a few quick things. It's hard to live on the coast right now and not be thinking about sea level rise because it is rising all around us. And I if you haven't seen it in the news, I would ask you to keep an eye and send good thoughts to our friends in Pacifica. Their pier is soon to be taken by the ocean, it looks like. Julie is a resident in Pacifica. I'm in Half Moon Bay, and it's a real landmark on the coast. So we're sad to see that go, but it is the reality of the age that we're living in right now. Important for fishermen, important to the community, and we are seeing these old infrastructure out into the ocean being deeply impacted. So keep an eye on that. I'll mention two other things. Climate is always on my mind. We're seeing some really interesting things on the farms in on the coastline this year, and one is that given the very, very mild winter that we had this past year, the fruit trees are totally confused. So this will show up in your grocery store and at your farmer's market in the not too distant future. Apples are anywhere from baseball size to not appearing at all. A lot of bare limbs on the trees. I reached out to the community. Is this normal given the winter we've had? But we haven't seen anything like this in about 15 years or more. And so it's troubling. It's a troubling sign, and it's worrisome. And it will show up in the grocery store at your market. So we're seeing that happen. And then the last thing is I think it's pretty fascinating to see around the coast. We're just 11 acres. Right next to us is a 320-acre flower farm, and there are much larger farms all around us that were part of this community. They are getting ready for an El Nino winter like we have never seen before, which means they're cleaning out drainages, and they're talking about maybe we should put rock in that drainage too, which I say, oh, no, let's get some help from the RCD. And so just know that people are listening to those reports. And Sean, I know you always keep an eye on the weather for us from what the forecasts are from Sacramento, but you may see some in the land management community looking for some help and some technical guidance. And in fact, maybe we can push something out in advance on how people can get ahead of these things. But it's definitely on people's minds. And I think they're not just listening to the news forecasts, but they're feeling it, as farmers do. Thanks.
Thank you, Board Member Batty. Board Member Ransom?
No.
Board Member Gunther?
Yeah, I was going to also mention that I'm hearing from a lot of people about the super El Nino. There's a way the messaging about it seems to have broken through, and a lot of people are thinking about it. And so as we get more information, I think it would behoove us to be part of delivering that information in whatever public channels we send it out. Last week was a public workshop at BCDC for the Sediment and Beneficial Reuse Working Group that I've been chairing. We have spent sort of a little over a year reviewing all the information about sediment and beneficial reuse in the estuary, and we are now in the process of developing an amendment for the San Francisco Bay Plan that will be likely changing parts of the Bay Plan to enhance and promote the beneficial reuse of sediment around the estuary. At the meeting beforehand, it warmed my heart to hear the colonel of the San Francisco Bay District call sediment a resource, as opposed to sediment being "quote unquote" spoils, as how it used to be thought of. You'll be hearing more about this as we go along. But the we've now moved into the amendment process, and then the third piece of the project is going to be thinking about how to fund enhanced beneficial reuse in the estuary.
Thank you, Board Member Gunther. Board Member Kissinger has nothing, and that means we'll go over to our Eileen, Executive Office highlights.
Great, thank you. Good morning, Board Members. We have a few items for you on the dais today, one of which is the updated strategic plan overview. As a follow-on to our board presentation in April, this overview highlights some of the key components of the strategic plan and the work we do here at the Water Board. We use the overview at recruiting events, public meetings, and have shared it with our colleagues at other agencies and other regions to help them understand what our authorities are and the work we do at the Water Board. As we shared in the Executive Officer Report, I'd like to highlight a couple of items. First, on May 28th, our MPDS division team organized an all-staff field trip and training. This educational field trip in May included a walk along the Embarcadero in San Francisco, a presentation on waterfront resilience by the San Francisco Port Authority, and a comprehensive training prior to the trip exploring the geology, earthquake, history of the San Francisco waterfront, along with the permits in the area that we oversee and the remediation work that's ongoing at Pier 39 through 43. We have included a copy, here it is, of the event agenda as well as the field trip tour guide at your seats in case you'd like to do the walk yourself or with your family members and to share the level of professionalism and engagement our team took to make this an incredibly informative event. The tour guide is really amazing. And then before we jump into some awards and retirements, I want to highlight two additions to our management team. Although she's on vacation today, pre-planned, we are excited to have Mary Cousins join the Water Board as the new MPDS manager. Mary is a licensed professional engineer with bachelor's and master's in civil and environmental engineering from Stanford University and a PhD from UC Berkeley in civil and environmental engineering. And she worked for over 10 years as an engineering consultant in the Bay Area, specializing in MPDS permitting, water recycling, and water resources planning. Prior to joining the Water Board, Mary was the regulatory manager for the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, also known as BAQA. I'm also very excited to share that Maggie Monahan, here in the audience, has been promoted to lead the Watershed Division. Maggie is also a professional engineer with a bachelor's in engineering degree from Penn State and a master's in civil and environmental engineering from Stanford, with a background in research and development focused on wastewater management and environmental compliance. She has been instrumental in so many programs at the Water Board in the development of our strategic plan, developing the onboarding procedures and onboarding events, and a key contributor to our team and workforce planning development. We are looking forward to Maggie bringing her strong technical skills, exceptional project management skills, and excellent communication skills to her new role as a Watershed Division Manager. And now, once again, I have the great pleasure of presenting not one, but three State Superior Accomplishment Awards. As a brief reminder, a Superior Accomplishment Award is presented to individuals who have made a difference on behalf of the state of California by positively impacting the work we do for the public and the communities we serve. The recipients are nominated for these awards and then are vetted through a committee within the State Water Board. Once a nomination is accepted and approved, each recipient receives a financial bonus, a formal certificate, and a presentation before the board and the public. So the first award today, and he's here and we'll do photos afterwards, I want to present is to Aiden Cicchetti. Aiden, if you could stand up, and we'll do photos afterwards. He's a senior water resource control engineer and section leader in the MPDS division. Aiden received a Superior Accomplishment Award for his contributions as part of the Water Board's statewide racial equity team. The state and regional boards are working toward a future where race no longer predicts a person's access to water or the quality of water resources they receive. And the Racial Equity Support Committee helps deliver on this initiative. Aiden has represented the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Board in this effort. We want to acknowledge and thank him for his commitment to our key priorities for advancing racial equity and environmental justice, in addition to all the other great work he does in the MPDS division. Thank you, Aiden. Our next Superior Accomplishment Award is for Liz Morrison, Senior Environmental Scientist and Section Leader in the Watershed Division. Liz will not be standing up today because she retired at the end of last month. But Liz truly deserved this award. She received this award for her statewide facilitation and regional interagency coordination, resulting in the establishment of the San Francisco Bay in lieu fee program. The In Lieu Fee program allows projects that are impacting wetlands to obtain mitigation credits for those impacts and allowing those projects to move forward while supporting needed wetland restoration in the Bay Area. Liz has spent more than 30 years at the water boards protecting creeks and wetlands, working on some of our region's most challenging projects. She retired in May from state service after hiring many new staff and working to develop them and train them on our watershed programs and 401 certs. We are so grateful for her many contributions and wish her well on her next adventures and look forward to her many travel updates. Next, we want to recognize John Madigan here, Water Resource Control in the MPDS division, who's sitting at the end of the table here on my left. John has received the Superior Accomplishment Award for his outstanding achievements, including the reissuance of the complex Lehigh Southwest Cement Company's MPDS permit for its Permanente plant in Cupertino, which its reissuance is on the agenda today. For more than 10 years, John has been the case manager for Lehigh's MPDS permit for treated processed wastewater and industrial stormwater discharges to the Permanente Creek. During that time, John has carefully navigated a complex and constantly evolving political, technical, and regulatory environment through three permit reissuance cycles. Each reissuance of Lehigh's MPDS permit receives a high degree of public scrutiny from interested parties with a variety of backgrounds and opinions. We're requiring John to balance divergent views on the nature of pollutant discharges from his site and identify how best to address them. Amid all these responsibilities, John has also found time to support and improve our programs by mentoring and encouraging junior staff, providing crucial feedback to management to improve internal processes, contributing to external working groups, and striving to create a welcoming and inclusive atmosphere in our agency. John is an outstanding and knowledgeable employee who represents the best of what it means to be a civil servant. His upcoming retirement at the end of this month represents a major loss of institutional knowledge for MPDS programs and supports for our staff, and you will be sorely missed, John. Thank you for your many years of service. Finally, I want to talk, as I said, we were going through transitions, talk about two bittersweet retirements that are effective at the end of this month. First, Yuri Wong, who's someone who is on vacation today and does not like a lot of attention. But as our regional counsel, I would be amiss in my duties if I did not acknowledge the incredible work she has done over the years, helping staff navigate through the municipal regional permits, coaching and guiding us on all sorts of water quality regulatory issues. And as you've seen the number of retirements in the last couple years, she has been very patient onboarding our new staff, helping them learn all our regulatory programs. As you'll recall, she also filled in when our Assistant Chief Counsel, Amel, stepped into a new role, and she continued to support our region with the help of Chech. We're so lucky to continue to have Chech. But Yuri has served as counsel, guide, editor, and friend to many of us at the Water Board throughout her 25 years, and she's worked through many transitions of the leadership and legal complexities with the work of the board. I, for one, will be forever grateful for her guidance and support and will miss her greatly, and just wanted to acknowledge that. And then our final retirement, and I believe they started on the same time, and they decided they were going to go out together, which was not good, seeing that they're both so invaluable to us. But the final retirement that I want to talk about is our incredible team member and invaluable colleague, Richard Looker. Richard, if you're in the room, please stand up. Richard is amazing. So Richard does so much behind the scenes. As a senior water resource control in the planning division, he has contributed to so much to our entire region, not to mention to improving water quality throughout the San Francisco Bay. His impact on the Water Board's work was immediate, extensive, and lasting. Over the years, he has developed site-specific objectives for copper and nickel in the Lower South Bay. He developed the total maximum daily low for mercury in San Francisco Bay, which we talked about in the EO report. He served as the Water Board's rep on the Technical Review Committee on the Bay Regional Monitoring Program. He led multiple efforts to update the list of impaired waters in the region, represented the Water Board in several statewide roundtables, mentored numerous staff, and most recently did the difficult job of translating nutrient monitoring data and models into effluent limits for the nutrient watershed permit that this board adopted in July of 2024. But perhaps most importantly, Richard did this work with a disarming smile and sharp wit. We sincerely appreciate all Richard's contributions, all the mentoring staff he has done over the last several years, and we want to wish him the best in his new adventures, including his travels to Germany. Richard, we are really going to miss you when we want to issue that next permit, and we'll see if we can get in contact with you in Germany. But want to wish you all the best. You've been a fabulous member of our team at the Water Board, so thank you.
Thank you, Eileen. Do there any comments or questions for Eileen?
I'll just say, she's not here. Maybe she'll watch the video, but a special thank you to Yuri, who's not here, who helped me through some navigating some issues along the way as well. Always helpful, particularly during all those crazy COVID years. So we appreciate that. And to all the awardees and the retirees, just fills my heart all the service that you've provided to our state. And thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Batty. And I'll second that because I've sent the most what-if questions to Yuri in my last 3 years. So very happy with that. Go ahead, Board Member Gunther.
Yeah, I want to obviously echo the congratulations. Every time I read both the descriptions of people who are leaving and the people who are coming, I just am stunned by the qualifications of the people who are working for us here. And I want you all to know that it makes me really proud to be a Region 2 board member because I know I'm working with such an extraordinary team of people, including Mr. Looker, who he and I have worked together for many years. And some may know him better as Rec 2 Man. I also would just like to ask, Eileen, it's my understanding that the president has just invoked the Defense Production Act to attempt to force a construction of a coal export terminal in Oakland. And at your leisure, whenever you can, I'm interested in whether that means that that eliminates any of our abilities as a state agency to regulate the impacts of this facility on San Francisco Bay, whether the Defense Production Act has some kind of, you know, unless Chet, you can tell me right now. But I'd like to understand the implications of that.
Great, thank you, and we'll work with our legal counsel and get back to you, Andy. Thank you.
And I'd just like to add that, at a time like this, I don't think we can spare Yuri. So we should at least have her back for some kind of roast. So. But I want to echo the other comments that have been made as well, and particularly single out John. I appreciate, I've been watching you here for the last 12 years, and I very much, well, I guess 10 years, but I very much appreciate your contribution over the many years here. So thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Kissinger. With that, Eileen, you're good? All right, I think that is going to close our reports, and we're going to move on to our next section here. Before we do that, before we proceed with the board items, I will administer the oath for today's hearing. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the discharger, and third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested parties. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witnesses by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this process. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise or raise their hand. Do you promise to tell the truth? And with that, I'll turn it over to Eileen to continue along our board agenda.
Great. Thank you, Chair Young. We have three uncontested items under agenda item six today. All three items are posted online as part of the board package. Item 6A is the reissuance of the MPDS permit for the Exploratorium Heating and Cooling System in San Francisco. Item 6B is the reissuance of the MPDS permit for the Lehigh Southwest Cement Company and Hanson Permanente Cement Incorporated and the Permanente plant in Santa Clara County. And finally, item 6C is the issuance of the waste discharge requirements for the Bedwell Bayfront Park landfill in Menlo Park. Staff are available to answer any questions about any of these items if the board has any questions.
Do we have any questions with the board members? Board Member Kissinger.
I had a couple questions, maybe this is, we'll find out. On the exploratorium matter, I was trying to understand how using the cool water from the bay could be used for heating. I understand the cooling part, but how does the heating part work?
This is James Parrish, Senior Environmental Scientist in the NPDES Wastewater Division. I will attempt to answer that question, and then I will also note that we have a representative online who might also be able to answer better than I can. The bay water does not heat the heating and cooling system at the exploratorium. The exploratorium has a system that heats and cools, and when it's time to cool, it will use the bay water, but they just call it a heating and cooling system because it has other mechanisms for heating the museum.
Thank you very much. I kept looking and trying to, I don't still understand how that works. So.
Okay. Any other questions? Julie, do we have any members of the public that would like to comment on any of these items?
No, we don't have any.
All right. Do we have any comments in the audience? Seeing none? Okay. I guess with that, do we have any, no questions or comments from the board? So does anyone like to make a...
I'll make a motion.
Thank you.
I was going to make a recommendation.
Oh, do you want to make a recommendation?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. I just want to recommend the board adopt all three uncontested items, items 6A, 6B, and 6C. Thank you.
Yeah.
So moved.
Oh, wait. 1 second.
I will second, and I also will just say that I always say this, but I can't let it go by. I do not ever take for granted the amount of work that goes into creating a consent calendar like this, both on behalf of the staff and behalf of the permittees, and it's greatly appreciated and acknowledged.
Yeah, and a good read. So Board Member Batty is our primary. We have a second?
I'll second.
And that's Board Member Kissinger. With that, could we have a roll call vote, Julie?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
And Chair Young?
Aye. And that motion carries for item 6A through C. Eileen, you can continue.
Great. Item 7 on our agenda today is a tentative order that would issue waste discharge requirements to the Santa Clara Valley Water District, also known as Valley Water, to implement the Coyote Creek Flood Protection Project along Coyote Creek below Anderson Dam. The project will reduce flooding in urban areas along about 9 miles of Coyote Creek in San Jose and will fill waters of the state to construct concrete flood walls, passive barriers, and earthen berms. We are supportive of the project's design because its elements are outside the immediate Coyote Creek channel, and they include, for example, coordination with the City of San Jose to use a municipal golf course as a floodway during high flow events. This allows improvements to the creek's flood management capacity while supporting important beneficial uses like fish habitat. Timothy Chen, Senior Environmental Scientist, will provide a presentation on this important project and discuss its impacts and mitigation. Following Timothy's presentation, we'll have a speaker from Valley Water talk.
Hello, my name is Timothy Chen. I'll be presenting the Coyote Creek Flood Protection Project.
Make this a little higher.
Thanks. Proposed by the Santa Clara Valley Water District. Valley Water proposes the Coyote Creek Flood Protection Project to reduce flood risks to the adjacent urban area, provide additional freeboard from future flow releases after the Anderson Dam seismic retrofit project is completed, and help the City of San Jose address stormwater runoff and drainage. The project, consisting of five reaches, spans 9 miles from Montague Expressway to Tolley Road in San Jose. All five reaches are authorized as part of this project and consist of various flood control improvements, which I will tell you about shortly. Today, you're considering a tentative order for waste discharge requirements because the projects are outside the Corps' jurisdiction. Valley Water has designed the project to avoid and minimize impacts within state jurisdiction to the maximum extent practicable. We think this is a great design because Valley Water is able to accomplish their flood protection goals without significantly modifying the creek. For example, throughout its development, the project's flood walls and berms minimize impacts to riparian habitat, and the project uses the San Jose Municipal Golf Course as a floodway. The project preserves much of the creek channel in its natural state. And the project is also a great demonstration of multi-agency coordination between the City of San Jose and Valley Water, which I will elaborate on later. Let me show you the location of the project. San Francisco Bay is visible at the top left of the map, north about 5 miles. The South Bay salt ponds are visible in the upper left corner of the figure as well. Coyote Creek is located in the City of San Jose, flowing south to north to San Francisco Bay. The Coyote Creek drainage area is shown in the figure as the lightly shaded outline. As I mentioned, the project reach is along a 9-mile reach of Coyote Creek from Montague Expressway at the downstream boundary to Tolley Road at the upstream boundary, passing through the urbanized area of San Jose. The main project purpose is to protect the community from the level of flooding that occurred in February 2017, which caused more than $100 million in damage. The 2017 flood was estimated as the 20-year flow, about 7,400 cubic feet per second, and this project is designed to protect against the same flood event and greater, so from 8,300 to 9,500 cubic feet per second. In this slide, I will show you some of the proposed project elements. Not described are some maintenance roads being improved to accommodate the flood control elements. So Valley Water used hydrologic modeling to determine where floodwaters would be expected to overtop the creek and implemented specific flood reduction improvements. The project consists of four elements: flood walls, vertical walls that contain and redirect flood flows, and of these two types, sheet pile flood walls, as shown in the upper left, and reinforced concrete flood walls, as shown in the upper right. Passive hydrostatic barriers, which are hidden at ground level to allow access to roads and open space until flood conditions trigger deployment. And their deployed state is shown at the bottom right with the hinges facing the channel, as well as berms, which are ridges and embankments that contain and redirect flood flows, shown on the bottom left. Not pictured are backflow prevention devices, including flap gates and check valves, which modify existing stormwater infrastructure to prevent backflow during high flow events. So I'm just going to go back. And board, what you're not seeing is some of these elements are located outside of the creek channel, preserving Coyote Creek's natural state, as opposed to a more impacting design involving hardscape and clear cutting of riparian vegetation. And this is the kind of design that we like to see because it really reduces impacts to the creek. The project will also include flood protection measures to an existing bridge. Instead of removing mature riparian vegetation and widening the capacity of the channel, Valley Water proposes to construct head walls, which are shown in the purple, the image to the right, and wing walls, shown in green. Work to reinforce the bridge would take place above the creek channel as well. All these elements contribute to the project's low-impact approach to preserve as much of the creek where possible. The slide shows the project impacts to state waters. Valley Water's project design minimizes impacts to the creek. Across its 9-mile length, the project will only permanently impact 0.4 acres, or 2,050 linear feet, and will temporarily impact 1.3 acres, or 6,095 linear feet. All project impacts within state jurisdiction are occurring in the riparian zone outside of the creek's slow flow channel. For mitigation, Valley Water plans to purchase advanced mitigation credits from the Valley Habitat Program in lieu fee program, specifically for the fulfillment of the San Felipe Creek Restoration Project, located within the Cowdy Creek watershed. The figure to the below left shows the site and the amount of credits reserved, that being 0.9 acres of riparian establishment and 0.3 acres of riparian enhancement. Cowdy Creek is listed as an impaired water body, with trash as a major stressor, heavily degrading its ecological functions. Trash and its removal provide opportunities for significant enhancement and improvement to Cowdy Creek's beneficial uses. The image to the bottom right shows a stretch of Cowdy Creek along Story Road, area known as the jungle, heavily impacted by homeless encampments and illegal dumping. This area has been cleaned up, but similar conditions can be found elsewhere along the creek, as I will show you in the next slide. This tentative order includes a trash removal plan. 3 tons of trash are proposed to be removed over 0.3 acres. Here are some pictures showing trash accumulation within project limits. These were taken at the eastern, southern, and western limits of the project by the wetland delineation team in 2024. So, in conclusion, the project proposed by Valley Water is a great demonstration of what can be achieved in urbanized areas with low-impact design elements and coordination with municipal government. It will provide 9 miles of flood protection improvements with minimal impacts to state waters and protect the residents of the city of San Jose against future flooding. On top of that, the project's impacts will be fully mitigated. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from the board? Board Member Batty?
Yeah, I have a couple questions, and I'm hoping Bill's going to help me because we were both on the board back then. I was hoping you could go back to this slide where you showed the flooding from 2017. And I just want to take a beat here because in 2017, when these floods occurred, and my question is going to be, so you can get ready. Tell us about the potential impact to your area, inundation area, from, you know, if this is not done. I think you had, yeah, there. So I just want to take a beat and say, you know, in 2017, when people came and spoke and the water district came and spoke, it was quite emotional. It was incredibly significant. You just said the number of the cost, $100 million. In flood, and definitely in, you know, as it often is, in areas that can least afford to have that impact. And so I'm very, very pleased to see this moving ahead. I would love you to talk just for a minute about what is the potential impact if this doesn't happen, and then I would also love to learn more about the schedule, because right away would not be soon enough, so...
Board Member Batty, I'll just note that we have John Bourgeois from Valley Water, who might be able to speak to those questions in a bit more detail if you're okay waiting for a minute.
Yeah, I'm absolutely willing to wait, but I just wanted to bring the human element into this.
Well,
you know, it's a very significant project and badly needed.
We had the opportunity to participate in a portion of the public meetings that Valley Water convened following that devastating, you know, floods, and certainly to observe and engage with the community and hear their very understandable concerns. I'll just say, you know, any project or any flood where both the mayor and the congressman for the area appear immediately to stand in front of the floodwaters is a significant flood.
So yes.
Thank you.
Just to pick up on Board Member Batty's question, to what degree will this actually prevent the flooding that happened in 2017 from reoccurring? What level of protection does this actually provide?
The take-home message, Mr. Kissinger, is that this will prevent the floods that occurred in 2017 from reoccurring. So they would be contained in the channel and within
But that was, so that was a 1-in-20-year event, supposedly. So
that's right.
With sea level rise, with climate change, is it a 1-in-50-year event? Is it a 1-in-100? Or let's, no one can say.
Let's put John Bourgeois on the spot and see if.
Okay.
And I think that's our cue to continue to Mr. Bourgeois. Is that right?
John is online.
Okay.
If we want to bring him up.
Wes is
go
on.
Go ahead and promote him, Wes.
And thank you for a great presentation.
Yeah. John, can you hear us?
Thank you. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. It took just a second to convert me to a panelist. Thank you so much. My name's John Bourgeois. I'm a deputy operating officer here at Valley Water. I oversee our watershed stewardship and planning division. First of all, Chair Young and board members, thank you for hearing this today. I really want to extend a sincere thanks to Timothy Chen. The draft order you have before you represents months of collaboration. I hope you can tell by, you know, the multiple miles of flood protection and only 0.4 acres of permanent impact that we really take our stewardship mission seriously and tried very hard to make this as low impact as possible while still affording these flood protection benefits. I have a few comments, but let me just cut to the chase and answer your questions first. Yes, this was designed to be, I think, the 25-year flood event. So this would, if this had been in place, the 2017 flood would not have occurred. But it also is working in conjunction with our Anderson Dam seismic retrofit project. So this project may not have quite picked up on the nuance in Mr. Chen's presentation, but this project is kind of done in a couple of phases. And this is part two. We are in the middle of doing a huge seismic retrofit on Anderson Dam. And while our reservoirs are water utility facilities, they do provide some incidental flood protection by attenuating peak flows. And so for us to actually take that dam all the way down to rebuild it for the seismic retrofit project, we need to have these flood protections in place. And as such, they are a little bit overbuilt. And so moving forward, once Anderson Dam is in place and effective, the level of service will be a little bit higher than the 25-year storm. So they do work in concert, but we do need to have these measures in place in the absence of the dam. That's why we really appreciate the timeliness of this order and how quickly staff was able to work with this, because it is very important to get the flood protection in place, but also so that we can move forward expeditiously with the Anderson Dam seismic retrofit project. So I hope that answers that question, but also construction is planned to start this October. It's already out to bid, and we are looking at completion in the fall of 2028. So this will move quite rapidly for a project of this size. I do want to acknowledge that we did submit a comment letter. Our chief concern was over the sediment reuse standards. There was a QAP that was being a quality assurance project plan that was being utilized for determining sediment screening criteria for reuse of materials. And that QAP was one that was developed by the Don Edwards Refuge for wetland creation in a tidal environment. And so we were just a little concerned that since this is kind of an upland and fluvial system with much less and less frequent interface and connectivity to water, definitely not a tidal environment, that it was not necessarily the most appropriate set of standards. And so we were just concerned that that would kind of become the default new starting standard for these sorts of projects. Thus, thus the reason we submitted the letter. We do understand and really appreciate staff's response to that. We do not wish this project to be delayed in any way, and given the very small amount of fill we have, we don't expect any changes to this order. Again, our concern that it was that this the Don Edwards QAP would be used as kind of the new default standard moving forward. We've been reassured by staff that that's not the case, and we really look forward to working with them to develop something for future Valley Water projects. We do have other projects, such as the Anderson Dam Tunnel project, our Yagas Creek Flood Protection project, that do have different standards. So it would be nice if we had one set of standards that Valley Water could use across all of our projects. Makes our project management a little easier when we're trying to beneficially reuse material. And so we did submit an alternative QAP, and we just hope that that could be used as a starting point for that conversation as we work with staff moving in the future. So I'll end there and just, again, express our thanks. Mr. Chin has been a pleasure to work with, and everyone at Valley Water has really been appreciating his efforts on this and all of our projects. So thank you, and I'm happy to stand by for further questions.
Thank you. Let's see if the board has board member Batty has a question.
Thank you, John. Appreciate all your comments, and I also read about the QAP, and I can see what you're doing there. Makes sense to me. What I wanted to ask is, I'm really pleased to hear that work will start so soon, but I am going to put you on the spot a little bit maybe and ask, what is the plan? Well, has there been any significant flooding between 2017 and now in this same area? And is there a contingency plan if we do, in fact, have a very severe winter this year for the communities that have been impacted?
Yeah, those are questions for John.
Yeah, for questions for John. Yes.
Yes. Yes. So, yes, the contingency plan, like I said, the Coyote Creek Flood Protection Project was kind of built in two phases. And so the first phase was done to make sure we could accommodate the flood in the absence of the dam. And now, once the dam's rebuilt, we have new tunnels and new outlets and new operations. And so this second phase is going to be to work in conjunction with that. So there's already a project under construction to handle the first part of it, and this is kind of the second phase of that. So sorry if I didn't articulate that properly.
No, I got
so,
you.
Yeah, there is.
So
there
you've already there been is, working on it. I'm looking at Keith Licton and waiting for him to nod.
Okay, I'm nodding, Board Member Batty. I wanted to add a couple of points to what John is saying, which is one of the things that the 2017 events spurred was also some fairly substantial discussions between Valley Water and the city around communication and recognizing both the sheltered and the unsheltered members of the community who were affected by the flooding. And so I'm sure that that's part of Valley Water and City of San Jose's sort of contingency events in the event of high water this winter. So not only the physical improvements, but also the sort of the active work during a response. I wanted to add one more note, which is John is being quite modest. He's referring, of course, to Valley Water's massive rebuilding of Anderson Dam and, of course, having to drain down Anderson Reservoir and deal with the flooding while it's in that state when there's no dam there, which is what we're doing here. And then, of course, rebuilding it. But he's not taking credit for additional work that Valley Water has done. And we always talk about watershed management. And one of the things that Valley Water has done along Coyote Creek, right, which is a Salmada Creek, it has cold water fisheries, is to prepare essentially a watershed management plan that prioritizes the kinds of preservation and restoration actions that we, the Water Board, and other agencies like the National Marine Fisheries Service want to see as Valley Water is doing these other improvements for water supply and flood management, that kind of thing. And so that's really enabling so preview of coming attractions, you will see future approvals for channel restoration, or at least we'll tell you about, depending on how it goes here. And this coordinating plan is really helping all of the agencies feel comfortable as this substantial amount of work goes forth on Coyote Creek, including this project. John, I don't know if you wanted to add anything there, but just to note that you're doing more work than what we're seeing in front of the board today.
Yes, thank you, Keith. I appreciate those comments. Yes, we have been working hard to get watershed plans in place for all of our five watersheds. We have them in place for three, and we're finalizing the last two this year. So if anyone's interested in that process, you can reach out to me. Yes, and our communication with the city is vastly improved. Our EOC operations, we've adopted new procedures through our EOC, and those relationships are much improved, and the process is definitely better. And I was corrected by my staff, and that Coyote Creek, we call it Project A and Project B. This Project B is before you. Project A was actually completed last summer. So that precursor project to allow us to take the dam down to prevent the flooding is in place. And then this is the part B to kind of finish the project and make sure we're wholly operational once the dam is and the new tunnels are operational. So.
All right. Well, thank you so much, John and Keith and Tim and the whole team and everyone. I'll look forward to hearing more about the completion of this project. Very exciting. Thank you for all the work.
Thank you, Board Member Batty. Do we have any other comments? Board Member Gunther?
Yeah, I have a question. I don't know whether this is for you, Tim, or for John, about just sort of the physics of this project. So obviously the creek is greatly constrained in the urban region of San Jose. So we are now going to constrain it further with more walls and things that pop up and everything, which is going to, as I understand it, raise the height of the creek downstream. And is the idea with the golf course that we can kind of pull the plug on the channel if needed? Is this Bernoulli's principle here? I mean, that we're going to end up accelerating the force of the water will go up and it eventually has to go somewhere, right? So is that part of that process that in an emergency we turn the golf course into the floodplain?
Tim, do you want me to take that?
Sure. Thanks. Thanks, John.
Yeah. Dr. Gunther, good to see you. I don't have my modelers on with me, but I can tell you we did take downstream impacts into account. But yes, being able to utilize some of the open space in the area, some of the parks, et cetera, with these passive barriers does allow for us to basically widen the floodplain with little impact. So I can get back to you with more detail about what the impacts were downstream.
Oh, John, that's not necessary. I just wanted to make sure I understood how this was working, that part of this is all working together as a unit to using the floodplain where you can is strategically important for being able to raise the flood walls in other places.
That is correct, sir.
Okay.
Yes, we tried to get as creative as possible with the landscape. As you know, it's a very constrained environment through that area of downtown San Jose. We tried to get as creative as we could utilizing open space to accommodate that.
Right. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks. And John, can you just remind us also when the dam project is scheduled to be completed? Because obviously the 2028 date you just stated is part of it, but just in general.
Yeah, I think we're looking at 2032 for the completion of that project.
All right. That's it for me. With that, any other comments from the board? Board Member Kissinger.
One follow-on question. So does the reservoir behind the dam serve as a water supply? And what's San Jose doing in the meantime, or what's Valley Water doing in the meantime?
We'll let John respond. Yes, they're drinking water reservoirs.
Yeah.
John, do you want to elaborate?
Yes, so Valley Water is the water wholesaler for the area, for the region, for the county. And we have a 10 reservoir system. And of course the largest storage facility is groundwater. But Anderson is so large, it is our largest facility, and all nine of our other reservoirs can fit inside of it. So making sure we have adequate drinking water is of critical importance during this period when we cannot hold water in that reservoir. So we are looking at making sure all of our reservoirs, other reservoirs, and our groundwater system are as full as possible and that we have imported water agreements in place. We actually had to re-plumb and create some new pipelines for our imported water system to bypass the Anderson Reservoir to make sure it can get into our system without needing to be held in that facility. So there was definitely a lot of other that we didn't really talk about, water utility infrastructure that needed to be built to make sure that we can continue to provide that source of drinking water during this period. And let's just pray we don't have a drought.
Very, very audacious, and I guess slightly off topic, but I guess my impression is that water demand is increasing with all of the data centers that are locating in the vicinity of San Jose. Is that, I presume, factored into your modeling between now and 2035?
We do have our water use projections, but honestly, we've been holding pretty steady with our demand levels. Our conservation efforts are quite robust, and you know, despite population increases, et cetera, we've been seeing pretty consistent water use as our conservation goes up. So we really are working on that aspect of it as well.
Yeah, all right. Congratulate you on the audacious scale of what you're doing. Really, congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you, Board Member Kissinger. With that, Julie, do we have any members of the public that would like to comment on any of these items?
No one's registered.
Thank you. And do we have any members of the public here who would like to comment? Seeing none, I'll bring it back and ask Eileen for the executive officer's recommendation.
Yes, I recommend the board adopt the waste discharge requirements for the Valley Water Coyote Creek Flood Protection Project.
Is there a motion and a second to adopt item 7 as stated?
I'll move.
I'll second.
Board Member Kissinger and Board Member Batty. With that, Julie, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
And Chair Young?
Aye. The motion carries. And thank you. Now, Eileen, would like to please proceed with item number 8 on the agenda for today?
Great. Item 8 on our agenda today is the Advanced Restoration Plan for Indicator Bacteria and Pyramid at San Francisco Bay Beaches in San Mateo County. The plan describes bacteria sources in the beaches watershed, proposes high-priority implementation actions to reduce loading from the sources, and identifies the regulatory mechanisms for the actions. The plan builds on existing efforts taken by the parties and includes water quality monitoring to evaluate effectiveness of the corrective actions and assess attainment of standards. Selena Louie, Water Resource Control Engineer in the Planning Division, will provide a presentation on the plan. Thank you, Selena.
Good morning, Chair Young and members of the board. My name is Selena, and today I will be describing the advanced restoration plan that we developed to address bacteria impairment at 6 San Francisco Bay Beaches in San Mateo County. The advanced restoration plan, or plan for short, identifies likely bacteria sources, outlines implementation actions, and establishes an adaptive management framework to improve water quality and protect recreational users. We are bringing before you, for your consideration today, a resolution to support implementation of this plan. The 6 beaches in San Mateo County addressed by the plan are indicated with orange dots on this map. The beaches do not meet the water quality objectives for bacteria. Oyster Point Beach and Kiteboard Beach have been on the 303D list of impaired water bodies since 2018. In 2024, Coyote Point Beach, Erkenbrack Park Beach, Gull Park Beach, and Marlin Park Beach were also placed on the 303D list due to elevated levels of fecal indicator bacteria. Monitoring shows that bacteria objectives continue to be exceeded at all 6 beaches. This triggers concern about potential human exposure to pathogens through water contact recreation and adversely affects the designated beneficial uses. The plan purpose is to identify likely sources of bacteria and implementation actions to improve water quality. I'll start with a brief overview of each beach addressed by the plan. The aerial image on the left shows the Oyster Point Park and Marina in South San Francisco. Oyster Point Beach is located in the marina's west basin on the far left of the aerial image. On the right is a picture of the beach with recreational users. Oyster Point Beach is surrounded by mixed-use buildings, the marina, and a park. Oyster Point Park and Marina has 408 usable slips, restrooms, a boat ramp, picnic facilities, a fishing pier, a ferry terminal, parking lots, a yacht club, and a corporation yard. Approximately 10% of the slips are occupied by liveaboards. The beach is small, about 200 feet of shoreline. A section of the popular San Francisco Bay Trail, shown in yellow in the aerial image, meanders through Oyster Point Park and Marina. There are also three stormwater outfalls draining into the West Basin. These outfalls, identified as purple triangles on the map, discharge runoff from the mixed-use areas and the park. The aerial image on the right shows the Coyote Point Recreation Area. The recreation area is owned and operated by San Mateo County and is bordered by the city of Burlingame to the northwest and the city of San Mateo to the southeast. Recreation area facilities include Coyote Point Beach, a marina, the Peninsula Humane Society, and SPCA, picnic areas, a playground, restroom facilities, and a few other commercial properties. The remaining four beaches in the project are located in Foster City. I will talk about Kiteboard Beach first. The aerial image on the top shows Kiteboard Beach on the bay shoreline near the western touchdown at the San Mateo Haywood Bridge. Baywinds Park is just to the northwest of the beach. Foster City improved Baywinds Park with new restrooms, rinse stations, a resurfaced parking lot, and synthetic turf in 2014. The beach area includes picnic tables and a section of the San Francisco Bay Trail. Kiteboard Beach has approximately 400 feet of shoreline. The image below shows the kite needed for kiteboarding in the foreground and kiteboarding in the bay in the background. The remaining three beaches, Erkenbrack Park, Gow Park, and Marlin Park, collectively called the Lagoon Beaches, are all located in residential neighborhoods along the Foster City Lagoon. The Foster City Lagoon manages stormwater collected from most of the city's catch basins. All three lagoons are rather small, approximately 420 feet to 475 feet of shoreline. The applicable water quality objectives for bacteria addressed for the plan are based on enterococci. Enterococci is a fecal indicator bacteria commonly used to assess the potential presence of fecal material and its associated fecal pathogens in salt water. The objective states that the geometric mean shall not be greater than 30 colony-forming units, or CFU, in any six-week interval, calculated weekly. A geometric mean is a way of averaging data that best represents average conditions when data sets are long and variable. The second part of the objective is a statistical threshold value, or STV. The objective is that the STV shall not be exceeded by more than 10% of the samples collected in a calendar month. To protect beachgoers from exposure to waterborne diseases, California law mandates weekly bacterial testing at public beaches with 50,000 or more annual visitors. The San Mateo County Health Department conducts weekly testing at the six beaches and the beach, The San Mateo County Health Department conducts weekly testing at the six beaches addressed by the plan, which are shown on the map with orange dots. We evaluated the past 7 years of weekly data to see if bacteria is still a problem at the beaches. That gave us a long record of enterococcus densities for these locations. The samples represent almost all type of conditions, including critically dry and wet years. We used the data to calculate weekly geomeans for enterococcus. I will talk more of the geometric mean in the next slide. This analysis found that all six beaches addressed by the plan exceeded the enterococci water quality objectives more than 16% of the time and thus are impaired. This graph shows the results of our data analysis. Again, the enterococci water quality objective geometric mean is less than or equal to 30 CFU. The beaches in the graph are shown left to right in the same order as north to south on the map in the previous slide. The green bars show the total number of geometric means we were able to calculate from the available data. The blue bar shows a number of geometric means that exceeded the water quality objectives, and the golden bar shows a percent of geometric means that exceeded the water quality objectives. The black box outlines the data from the lagoon beaches. You will notice that the lagoon beaches have higher geomeans and higher exceedance rates than the beaches along the bay shoreline. Unlike the bay beaches, which experience regular tidal flushing and mixing, the lagoon beaches have more limited circulation and water exchange. These conditions can promote the accumulation and persistence of bacteria, resulting in higher Enterococcus concentrations. All six beaches are in very similar, highly urbanized areas. We use microbial source tracking studies and a literature review to identify potential sources to bacteria to the beaches in the plan. Sources of bacteria can include human waste from sources such as sanitary sewer systems, marinas, residents experiencing unsheltered homelessness, and trash. Dog waste is another source of bacteria. Nuisance wildlife waste, such as goose and seagull waste, and stormwater discharge are other sources of bacteria to the beaches. Dogs are often seen at the beaches and in the surrounding areas, and microbial source tracking test results show that some bacteria in samples are from dogs. Geese and seagulls are very often seen at the beaches. Microbial source tracking test results also often showed geese and seagull bacteria in the samples. As I mentioned before, with the exception of Kiteboard Beach in Foster City, the other beaches all have nearby storm water outfalls, which can bring bacteria from the watershed to the beaches. Sources in the watershed include sanitary sewer collection systems, municipal stormwater runoff, and domestic pets. The plan describes a problem and includes an implementation plan to address it. The implementation plan focuses on enhancing existing efforts and programs. These include actions to eliminate sanitary sewer overflows and illicit connections to the storm drain and actions to minimize pollutants in municipal stormwater. The plan also includes proposed tasks for the marina to continue existing actions for controlling vessel waste discharges and identifying other needed actions. The plan calls for assessment of beach water quality data and encourages supplemental monitoring to improve understanding of remaining bacteria sources. The plan's adaptive management framework allows for context-specific implementation, monitoring, and refinement of actions over time. We will be evaluating implementation progress on an annual basis, including assessment of completed actions, source investigations, and supporting water quality monitoring data. As the plan was being developed, we worked with stakeholders and kept them informed about this project. During the public review period, we received comment letters from the California Stormwater Quality Association, or CASQA for short, and the San Mateo Countywide Water Pollution Prevention Program, or the San Mateo Program for short. We responded to the comments in the response to comments document and Appendix D of your package. In response to some specific comments, we made a few clarifying revisions in the plan. The clarifying revisions are non-substantive. Before I talk about the clarifying changes we made to the plan in response to comments, I will take a few moments to talk about what an advanced restoration plan is compared to a total maximum daily load, or TMDL. This is because one of the comments asked about the potential progression over time from the plan to a TMDL. Under the Clean Water Act, impaired waters generally require a TMDL to be developed to address pollutants causing an impairment. However, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency also recognizes advanced restoration plans as near-term pathway where implementation actions can be initiated more quickly and adaptively to restore water quality. Compared to a TMDL, which requires development of load allocations and administrative rulemaking that can take multiple years, an advanced restoration plan can often be implemented more quickly while still focusing on source identification and implementation. If these efforts are unsuccessful in achieving water quality standards, we may still need to develop a TMDL in the future. In the case of the plan for these six San Mateo County beaches, most of the actions that would be required by a TMDL are already incorporated into the plan. Next, I will briefly discuss some of the specific comments and the clarifying revisions we made to the plan. In response to CASWA and the San Mateo Countywide Water Pollution Program's requests, we clarified that any future decision regarding TMDL development would be based on a weight of evidence approach that considers implementation progress, source identification efforts, supporting monitoring information, and evaluation of water quality trends. We also clarified that additional time might be provided for implementation and monitoring before proceeding to a TMDL. If task implementation is ongoing and data are insufficient to evaluate trends. In response to the San Mateo Countywide Program's requests, we also clarified that implementation efforts should be prioritized based on watershed sources and available information. The plan provides flexibility for the implementing parties to determine the most appropriate actions and encourages the implementing parties to prioritize sources based on contributions to their respective watershed. Finally, in response to another request from the San Mateo Countywide Program, we recognize that implementation measures relating to complex social or infrastructure issues, such as those associated with unhoused population, require a multi-agency approach. The San Mateo Countywide Program also commented that attainment evaluations should distinguish between dry weather and wet weather conditions. We recognize that weather conditions influence bacteria levels and potential impairment. However, the water quality objectives are not differentiated by weather conditions. Nevertheless, the plan's adaptive management framework provides flexibility to consider site-specific conditions and seasonal patterns. Lastly, the San Mateo Countywide Program commented that the plan does not account for background sources when interpreting monitoring results. The water quality objectives are not source-specific for attainment evaluation. Therefore, they are based on ambient conditions. At this stage, implementation efforts need to be focused on identifying and addressing controllable human-caused sources of bacteria through tools such as microbial source tracking and targeted investigation. Once controllable sources are better understood and addressed, additional evaluation of background contributions may be appropriate. Therefore, we did not revise the plan as requested. In conclusion, I have described the problem of bacteria impairment at six San Francisco Bay beaches in San Mateo County. I discussed the proposed implementation actions in the Advanced Restoration Plan to address that bacteria problem. We are bringing before you for consideration today a tentative resolution that supports implementation of the Advanced Restoration Plan. This concludes my presentation. We are happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Selena. That was a good presentation. Do we have any comments from the board? Board Member Batty?
I have a bunch of questions, or maybe it's just one big question. First of all, thank you. This has been many years in the making, and so glad to see. I would love to see San Mateo beaches off the list of the worst beaches in the state. And it's very easy to understand what's going on here on these beaches. these are areas of potential high use, and the idea that the water is not clean is really something we need to be on top of. My question is really about the implementation. And so who are the responsible parties? And there's so many of them, as I look through your plan. How are they, like in a, if we were doing a watershed planning study, maybe the RCD or somebody would bring them all together and say, this is how we're going to tackle this together. Who's playing that role in this? And how long do we give them before we enforce that they must play this role? Or are they cooperative and ready to go? Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
For the Foster City watershed, it is entirely Foster City's responsibility. For the Coyote Beach watershed, we have the county who's the owner of the beach, and then we have the two cities who discharge nearby, which would be the city of San Mateo and the city of Burlingame. For the Oyster Point Beach, which is owned by the city of South San Francisco, and they have a very good working relationship already with the Harbor District, who operates the marina. So they're divided by watershed, and we have encouraged implementing parties to have someone take a leadership role, particularly for Coyote Point Beach and Oyster Point Beach, so there'll be some coordinated, prioritized effort.
And then what's their time? Can you say more about the timeline for them to, like, submit a plan and be organized and get it going? And how will we will monitor that?
Yes. So the implementation plan already outlines actions that need to be taken, and they are required to submit annual reports to us, which we will evaluate annually and look at it more closely at the 5-year and 10-year mark.
Okay. Well, I'll just throw this out here. The Resource Conservation District in San Mateo County covers not just the coast, it covers a big area, and they have just huge expertise about making these complex models work when you have lots of parties involved. So maybe they would be helpful, at least as consulting entity. Anyway, I think it's fabulous. Thank you, and I hope it all moves forward with vigor.
Thank you for the suggestion. We will be in contact with them and bring the implementation parties into the discussion.
Thank you, Board Member Batty. Board Member Kissinger.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I'm wondering if you could go back to the slide which showed the graph, the bar graph. I just wanted to ask a couple questions about that.
Are you talking about the exceedances?
It's the third or fourth slide on your presentation. There, nope. Just went past it.
Almost there. One more. Maybe two more.
It's after that. It's the one that shows the frequency of and extent to which it exceeded there, that one. So I just want to understand, the green bar is the number of GMs. Tell me again what GM stands for.
Could you repeat the question, please?
What does GM stand for, the green?
Geometric mean.
Geometric mean. And so for taking Coyote Point, 250 represents 250 sampling events. What does 250 GMs mean?
250 geometric means.
But that's each one is a sampling event?
Not necessarily.
Is it the 5-week period, over the 6-week period?
Good morning. This is Farhad Gujarati. I'm an environmental scientist in the planning and TMDL division. I had a minor role supporting Selena in this project. So geometric means are calculated based on 5 or 6 samples. So 250 is 250 calculated geometric mean data points. So
those are the calculations using a six-week series. And, yes. And that's over that entire period. So for Coyote Point, it's 250 over that 6-year period.
I don't remember the time period over the
7 years.
7 years or so, yes.
Yeah. And I guess one thing I didn't really see in the materials and I was curious to understand is, does this frequency reflect and relatively evenly spread across the 12-month year, or is it concentrated just during a certain time of the year? I mean, the percentages, when you look at the report itself, where you've got exceedance rates of, you know, upwards of 60% in Foster City, is that across the year? Is that just all concentrated in 6 months of the year? What does that represent?
For most of the beaches, it is the entire year. For the lagoon beaches, because they are not tidally influenced, they are sampled almost weekly. For the shoreline beaches that are tidally influenced, they may skip a few weeks here and there, but for the most part, they are sampled year-round.
And the sampling that you're doing consistently then shows across all months of the year exceedances.
Yes.
And the ultimate objective is to take these beaches off the 303 list, so to get below that 16% triggering piece.
Yes.
I understand the reluctance to go to TDML standards because, back to Board Member Batty's question, I don't know how you impose on the parties that are responsible for the beaches something that will consistently control all the different sources that are contributing to the exceedance. Do we think this will ultimately accomplish that goal? I mean, it's such a challenge that, I mean, unless you start training the geese.
the city of Foster City is actually taking lots of steps to manage the geese, and including modifying the habitat in order to not make it attractive to geese. So there are actually things you can do, and whether...
You're putting coyotes out there?
whether this will ultimately achieve water quality standards waits to be seen, but we do believe that it will improve water quality. And through monitoring and adaptive management, we can strive to achieve the water quality objectives.
And when do we think we'll actually decide it's working or not working?
That's an excellent question that will be answered by the monitoring data, but it will it'll take at least 10 years of continuing to look at this as it goes on. I mean, we need a long temporal time period. We have to see when the measures are getting implemented, and these sorts of plans don't fix water quality overnight. They take time, and what we'll be looking for is continual improvement over time. And so, you know, we'll be checking back periodically to see whether we see that continual improvement.
I shouldn't ask this question, but I will. Is there any risk that someone would come to us and say, it's been 5 years, we're all six locations are still on the list?
I think the goal is, as Javier said, it's progress. So what we're going to be doing, and as Selena said, they're going to report each year. So we'll see each year. We're going to see what the measures they're doing, what are they executing on, and what the results are. So as Javier said, we may not, be off the 303 list in 5 years, 7 years, but if we're seeing progress, and it takes time, and there's different sources of pollutants and bacteria. So I think the main thing is that we're moving forward and that the agencies we're working with are also sticking to the plan, they're executing on what they're supposed to, and they're reporting. So what we're hopeful for is over the 10-year period, we're going to see gradual improvement each year generally is what we're hoping for.
Very, very challenging.
I'll just add to Eileen's remarks to note that the staff to my left have quite a bit of experience working with bacteria impairments, and the plan that's before you today, or the resolution supporting the plan, reflects those actions that make sense to try and control the things that we can control or work with others to control them. Bacteria are alive. It's a complex issue. We're in discussion not only in California but with others nationally who are working on it to try and figure out, what else remains to be done. But in the short term, this sets forth those actions that make sense to do.
Thank you very much.
I'm just going to add in, it's such a challenging topic. And in Half Moon Bay, there are a couple of beaches that are bacteria impaired, and it's been going on for as long as I've lived there, which is a very long time, despite lots of efforts. But can I just ask, in these beaches in particular, these six, every time the exceedance is that we're exceeding safe levels, are the beaches posted for safety? Okay. I mean, I think that's really important.
For the record, yes.
For the record, yes?
Well, it needs to be documented in the record. Head nods don't count. So, yes, the beaches are posted when the exceedances are
occurring. Yeah. I mean, I just think that's a very important part of this, that if, and I think it also sends a message to the community that, you know, we really need to work harder together to get these beaches at the right level. Yeah.
Board Member Gunther?
Yeah, a couple of questions. This group of beaches in San Mateo County, how many beaches do we have in the region that are listed, three or three listed for bacteria? Is this most of them? Is this just a small group? Are these the most serious exceedances?
I don't know the exact number, but this is actually the second Bay Beaches pathogen TMDL. ARP. We adopted a pathogen TMDL for, I want to say about six, but we'll have to look it up for you, Andy, within the San Francisco Bay. We also, as Jane was alluding to in Half Moon Bay, we have a TMDL there for, I think, three or four beaches. We have another pathogen TMDL for San Vicente Creek? And it's an ARP as well. And then there's Tamales Bay. To get the exact number, Andy, we'll have to get back.
I didn't mean the one to get the exact number. I was trying to get I'm trying to sort in my head that I remember the stuff in Half Moon Bay, but there are other beaches in the region that we have already adopted some kind of control measures for, and the control measures we are going to be suggesting here, are those informed by what we've done before, and have we seen? I know that these data can be highly variable, so it makes trend analysis difficult. But have we seen improvements in the places where we've already been working?
So yes, it's informed by the previous plans that we put in place to improve water quality. And yes, we are seeing improvements in, especially with the longer term TMDLs that we've had in place. For the urban creeks, that's still relatively new, and we don't have a long enough data set in the urbanized areas to really say so. But in the outer coast, we are seeing improvements.
It has always been my understanding that the exceedances are highly, much more frequent during wet weather conditions. Is that still true?
Yes, generally speaking, that's true.
Okay, and the Foster City beaches are particularly sort of hydrodynamically constrained examples in our region, right? I mean, that a lot of the beaches on the bay, it didn't surprise me to see the distribution of the data there. So these are a particularly challenging situation to work in.
That's correct.
Okay. And then the last question I have is about the species-specific identification of the Enterococcus bacteria. So back when I was actually doing chemistry, this was something that was very, very rare and new. We seem to be getting much more confident at it. I have never before been presented with the idea that we are separating out seagull and geese Enterococcus samples. But if we're doing that, then it seems to me that gives us a huge understanding of the source of the problem. And so I was surprised to not see our exceedances broken up in that way so that
I mean, you have that information, you're just not sharing it with us. I mean, this begs me the question, are geese the problem? Are leaking sewers the problem? If we have this ability to be so species specific like this?
Right, so that's a great question. To clarify, the microbial source tracking that uses genetic fecal markers, it doesn't separate different sources of enterococci. It's based on another group of bacteria called bacteroides that don't have anything to do with general fecal integrator bacteria like E. coli or enterococci, which are water quality objectives are based on. Generally speaking, MSD methodology is useful in identifying the sources, wherever they come, which host species they come from, the fecal pollution. But we are not where we need to be to use them for source apportionment, to try to determine which source is dominant, because their data is not to be used quantitatively. It's basically used to show the prevalence of different sources, which sources are, first of all, present, and secondly, at what frequency we detect them. But there are several confounding factors that prevent us from using the data quantitatively when we are looking at them interspeciously, if that's a word, as opposed to intraspeciously.
But the enterococcus standard then is, yes, any type of enterococcus bacteria, and it could be these bacteria that we're measuring that are contributing to the exceedances. These could be have a human source, they could have an avian source, they could have another mammalian source. Mm-hmm. We don't know. And we're in essence we're looking at the presence absence of these other bacteria as a way to help us correlate what might be the source, but we can't use them the way I described. Mm-hmm. We can't yet do that.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And Board Member Ransom.
Yeah, just real quick. Thank you for the presentation. Very nice. Looking at the implementation plan, you know, the various activities from sanitary sewer to geese, and recognizing the bay environment's different than the shoreline environment, is there something in this overall plan that's going to kind of focus on some early wins in the project? Because I think it's a 10-year kind of time frame we're looking at. So I'm just wondering if there's some of these things like sanitary sewer leaks, you know, go after those first, you know, to really get some good numbers on the scoreboard and just kind of figure out how it plays out.
That's a very good point. Like any implementation plan, this particular implementation plan is very adaptive. So we allow each community to focus on its top priorities or what may be the sources for them. So we gave it up to them because the top source in Foster City may not be the top source in the city of San Mateo, for that example. Like any other implementation plan, we envision that they will focus on the lowest hanging fruits first, the ones that are easy and will give them the biggest bang for the buck in terms of bacteria reduction, which could be for one community, it could be sanitary sewer overflows. For another community, it could be something else.
I would also add that for all the sources, they all need to take actions as soon as possible. Generally speaking, we are asking them to send us a plan within 6 months or so of the adoption, if the plan gets adopted, and then another 5 years to implement control measures. And then there is a major kind of checkpoint after 5 years to see where the water quality is headed. And at that point, if we are not meeting the water quality objectives, then they would need to enhance or include additional base management practices for the next 5 years.
Thank you.
With that, Julie, do we have any registered speakers?
Yes, we have one speaker. James Lem from Bowman Consulting Group is remote online.
All right, James, if you're online, I'm going to get you promoted. let us know if you can hear us.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
We can. The floor is yours.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Good morning, San Francisco Regional Board. My name is James Lim. I'm a senior scientist with Bowman Consulting Group, and I'm here today on behalf of Foster City in support of the Advanced Restoration Plan for Indicator Bacteria Impairment. So firstly, we appreciate the Regional Board's work in developing a clear, consistent framework for protecting water quality in these important recreational waters. And Foster City is fully supportive of the plan and its goals. And I wanted to highlight that the city has had a long history of proactively managing water quality within its systems. The city has been working with lagoon management plans since 1986, which has guided water quality and circulation management for decades. And building on that foundation, Foster City completed a comprehensive update in 2022 to that plan to reflect current conditions and improved understanding of water quality dynamics. Leading up to that update, the city also worked with consultants to perform conducted targeted monitoring and technical evaluations, which helped them to better understand sources of impairment at its beaches. That work informed the updated lagoon management plan and helped identify key drivers of exceedances of water quality parameters, including fecal indicator bacteria. In response, the city developed a goose management plan in 2024 to address the Canadian geese as a significant source, reflecting a shift towards targeted source-specific controls. In parallel, the city continues to implement stormwater and sewer system maintenance, sediment and debris management, and other source control best management practices. Foster City also conducts its own enterococci monitoring to supplement and cross-check county data, supporting more informed and responsive management decisions. From our perspective, this restoration plan aligns closely with the work already underway in Foster City and provides a valuable regional framework while still allowing for site-specific solutions. In closing, Foster City supports the plan and looks forward to continuing to work with the regional board and regional partners to improve water quality. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lim. Are there any additional Zoom participants waiting to speak on the line?
None registered.
And do we have anyone in the room who'd like to comment? No, very robust conversation. Thank you so much.
Donald, can I add one last note? I just want to add a note. Thank you, Foster City, for your ongoing commitment. And I know San Mateo County as a place of strong environmental values. We've got to do better. Like, I just think we have to do better. This plan lays out what better looks like, and we have to do better. So I am going to ask Eileen and Donald if you could think about bringing this back a year from now and letting us know how it's going, how the cooperation is going between parties, because it's going to take a lot. So thank you so much for taking action on this. But I don't know, I'm partly speaking of a grandmother of five small children that I do not want playing on beaches that are polluted. So we can do better.
Definitely understand. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Don, can I ask one more question? We have also been presented with data regarding bacteriological exceedances in stormwater for different communities, and the Baykeeper was involved in, I think, in suing or whatever the legal process was. As we are doing, is the source ID work that is being done, say, by Foster City in conjunction with us, is that informing us regionally, or do we find that each creek, each city has a different mix of sources such that we almost have to do this work individually in each beach watershed to understand the sources?
A lot of the sources are similar, but there are differences between watersheds. So I think it would behoove us, I mean, the techniques for assessing it and to investigate it are the same, but each watershed is going to be a little bit different. Like the one beach here is right next to a marina. Not every beach is next to a marina. And so to really understand the sources, you need to look at the beach and you need to look at the contributing watershed to really do your investigation. So it's watershed by watershed.
But I understand that we were also being presented with exceedance data that
is from sloughs and places that are not actual recreational, like, waterways. I mean, it's a little different. I mean, maybe I'm not remembering this right, but I'm trying to get my head around all the times that we as a board are presented with this kind of information that we are violating the Enterococcus standard. And I'm trying to just understand whether what we're doing today can be used to address all these things, or whether some of these exceedances are still sort of like a mystery in terms of the source, right? Because there were out of court settlements in relation to violations, and is that similar, or is that like almost a different issue?
Well, in short, we're in the urbanized Bay Area, and bacteria are an issue in creeks. Board Member Batty, as you pointed out, we're discussing today, and along a number of beaches, in sloughs, in and adjacent to the bay. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out that we do hear from the kayaking community and other folks who are in those sloughs on a regular basis. But what is before you today is the framework that's being applied broadly, whether in Sunnyvale and Mountain View, in the case of their engagement with Baykeeper, Pacific Estate Beach, on the coast, and so forth. So, I mean, this is a framework, and the details vary depending on the site. But
okay, that was where I was getting at, is that this is a regional problem, and each time we take these steps with the plans in particular areas, we are building a regional response to this issue.
Yeah, that's right. We're learning from what as we go.
Yeah.
Thank you, Board Member Gunther. And with that.
Actually, before you, with that.
One more time.
But we're doing both things. We are putting in place, at some beaches, TMDLs. In this case, we're choosing instead to do an advanced restoration plan rather than a TMDL. And I guess the question that's sort of lurking in my brain is, are we doing this because we can do it more quickly? Are we doing this because a TMDL is very difficult to impose in these particular circumstances because we don't know how to control it exactly? So what, you know, and just to finish out the question, you know, so for example, you know, along the coast, the beach that Jane referred to, there I took it that we put in place in TMDL because we knew exactly what the source of the problem was and how it could be controlled. Is that why we put in TMDL rather than an advanced restoration plan? I guess I'd benefit from understanding how we're making those choices.
I guess what you've heard is, and you heard from James from Foster City, you've heard from in the presentation today, that we have the partners want to improve water quality. So they all share Board Member Batty's vision, and it's a complex problem, whether it's stormwater, it's the geese. So Javier and his team have put together this plan where we're fortunate we have the parties that want to make the change, and we think this will happen faster. We're going to evaluate, as Selena said in her presentation, it's adaptive. So we feel like we could probably make a bigger impact quicker, and we're going to evaluate how it goes. But we're very fortunate that, as we heard today, that the different parties want to improve the beaches. It's a regional problem with these beaches, and it needs a regional solution. And the good thing is we've got a framework with this plan, and we've got committed partners. And feel free, Javier and Keith, to add to that.
Well, I'll just add the rulemaking process. So the ARP is non-regulatory. So it's important, as Eileen points out, that we have willing partners in the advanced restoration plan. Advanced restoration plans are still relatively new, so some of our TMDLs were put in place before there was even the concept of an advanced restoration plan. But generally speaking, it's much faster to go through a non-regulatory plan versus a rulemaking plan, which would add probably a couple years.
I'll just add to Javier's note, as one example, we have a range of water bodies that have bacteria impairments. You are not seeing everything. One example is Muir Beach, right downstream of Muir Woods. And there we were working with, was it the Park Service? They got a grant. That was an unusual situation where we thought the primary source was likely from some septic systems on the hillside. Mm-hmm. Part of that grant was to reorient the parking lot
which provided a substantial additional buffer between Redwood Creek and that potential source. Lo and behold, the impairment was resolved. And so that case, that was something that didn't come before you because folks were working on it proactively before it got to that point.
Interesting. Keith, if I may add, there's one more reason why it and ARP also makes sense in this case. Oh, yes, this is Setanai Boskut Frukt in the Planning Division. As Javier mentioned, in an urban setting, the bacterial sources are well known, stormwater runoff, sanitary sewer, you know, pet waste, these are known pathways. But in this case, we do know the sources, and many of the actions that would be required under a regulatory TMDL, we already have existing authorities to address these problems. So this is a lot quicker and more efficient way to address without developing a new regulation like the TMDL.
Great. Thank you.
That's robust, right? And with that, Eileen, I'll ask for the executive officer's recommendation.
Yes. I recommend the board adopt the resolution to support implementation of the Advanced Restoration Plan for Bacteria at 6 San Francisco Bay Beaches in San Mateo County.
So moved, and thank you to the team.
I guess we have a motion from Board Member Batty. Do we have a second?
Second.
Board Member Ransom. With that, Julie, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Batty.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
And Chair Young.
Aye. And thank you guys so much for the presentation and the robust conversation. It was very good. With that, we're going to keep on going. Eileen, next item on the agenda is item 9.
Great. So item nine is an informational item that provides an update to the strategy for revising the San Francisco Bay PCB's total maximum daily load, or TMDL. Staff will provide an update on the work to control sources of PCBs to the bay, including cleanup of upland and in-bay sites contaminated with PCBs, and describe the coordinated approach being taken by staff from multiple programs across the San Francisco Bay Water Board. Setanai Boskut Frukt, Senior Water Resource Engineer, and Katie Kula, Senior Water Resource Engineer, will provide the presentation on behalf of the Water Board. Following their presentation, Dr. Lisa Sabin, Managing Scientist at EOA, will present the Municipal Regional Permit, MERP, Permittee PCB update on behalf of the Bay Area Municipal Stormwater Collaborative. And Rob Carson, the Stormwater Program Administrator for the Marin County Stormwater Pollution Prevention Program, will then present on behalf of the Phase 2 permittees. I'm now going to turn it over to Setanai to begin the presentation. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Young and board members. My name is Setanai. Today, my colleague Katie and I will provide an update on our work related to polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, in San Francisco Bay. I will begin with an overview of the PCB TMDL maximum daily load, PCB total maximum daily load, or TMDL, and our TMDL revision strategy, what we have learned since the TMDL was adopted in 2010, and then Katie will provide an update on contaminated site cleanup efforts and coordination activities underway across water board programs. Our presentation today focuses on three key points: why PCBs remain a significant water quality problem in the Bay, what we have learned through implementation, site cleanup efforts, and recent scientific studies, and how we are adjusting our strategy to accelerate the Bay's recovery. PCBs are synthetic industrial chemicals that were widely used from 1930s through the 1960s in electrical equipment, hydraulic systems, building materials, paints, sealants, and many other industrial products. Although PCBs production was banned in 1979, these chemicals remain in the environment because they are extremely persistent and bind strongly to soils and sediments. Today, PCBs continue to enter the bay through legacy contamination in urban areas. Sources include erosion of contaminated soils, releases from old building materials and pavement sealants, illegal dumpings, and leaks from older electrical equipment still in use. PCBs accumulate in sediments and move through the aquatic food web. Over time, they concentrate in fish and wildlife and can also expose people who consume contaminated fish. Exposure to PCBs has been linked to serious health impacts, including cancer, developmental and neurological effects, immune system suppression, and endocrine disruption. Due to elevated PCBs levels in fish from San Francisco Bay, state health agencies have advised the public since the 1990s to limit consumption of certain bay-caught fish. And San Francisco Bay was listed as impaired by PCBs in 1998 in the Clean Water Act 303D Impaired Waters List. In the decade following the impairment listing, we established that PCB contamination is spread widely across the landscape of the bay watershed, mixed deep into the sediments in the bay, and is moving through the bay food web. In response to fish consumption advisories and the impairment listing, this board adopted in 2010 a TMDL, which is a water quality attainment strategy, with a 20-year timeline to restore beneficial uses related to commercial and sport fishing. The TMDL established a fish tissue concentration target of 10 micrograms total PCBs per kilogram of fish, or parts per billion, which is protective of both human health and wildlife. The graph on the right shows PCBs concentrations in shiner surf perch over time, which is one of the primary indicators used to track bay-wide impairment. Although some progress has been made in identifying and controlling PCB sources, concentrations in fish remain substantially above the target. The most recent bay-wide average concentration measured in shiner surf perch was approximately 220 parts per billion, which is about 18 times higher than the TMDL target. Importantly, long-term monitoring has not yet shown a clear bay-wide declining trend. The TMDL evaluated both external and internal PCB sources to San Francisco Bay. External sources include delta inflow from the Central Valley watershed, atmospheric deposition, municipal and industrial wastewater discharges, and urban stormwater runoff. The total contribution from all sources were estimated to be 34 kilograms of PCBs per year. Although Central Valley watershed contributes a substantial PCBs mass to the bay, approximately 11 kilograms per year, those loads are associated with lower concentration sediments that may contribute to burial of more contaminated in-bay sediments. Atmospheric deposition is considered a net loss pathway. Municipal and industrial wastewater discharges are much smaller contributors and are already well below their respective waste load allocations. Urban stormwater runoff remains the largest controllable source, contributing approximately 20 kilograms per year of PCBs. The bay also contains a large reservoir of PCBs contaminated sediments. PCBs stored in bottom sediments continue to move around the bay due to bed erosion, biological mixing, dredging, and in-bay disposal of dredged sediment, and provide an ongoing supply of PCBs to the water and biota. These sources are substantially larger than annual external loads, in fact, 1 to 2 orders of magnitude larger. This large sediment reservoir explains why bay recovery is inherently slow. Urban stormwater runoff continues to be the largest controllable external source of PCBs to the bay. The PCBs TMDL assigned urban stormwater programs the largest reduction responsibility by requiring 90% reduction by 2030 to achieve the urban stormwater wasteload allocation of 2 kilograms per year. Implementation has occurred primarily through successive municipal regional stormwater permits, or MRPs. Over the past 3 permit cycles, municipalities have made important progress in identifying PCB source areas, developing regional programs and technical tools, and implementing source control, treatment, and best management practices. These efforts significantly improved our understanding of PCBs contamination across the urban landscape. However, bay-wide reductions in PCBs loading have not occurred at the scale or pace necessary to substantially accelerate recovery. In other words, while implementation has advanced, we have not yet reduced PCBs loads enough to move the needle to change bay recovery trajectories. Having said that, the picture looks more optimistic if we look at certain margin areas around the bay. While bay-wide recovery remains slow, recent studies show more encouraging trends at smaller geographic scales around the bay margins. Over the last decade, scientific studies shifted our focus from the open bay to select contaminated areas around the margins where impairment is greatest, where watershed load reductions are pursued, and where we can track a measurable recovery. These margin areas are referred to as priority margin units, or PMUs. They are shown on this slide clockwise from top left, Emeryville Crescent, San Leandro Bay, Richmond Harbor, and Steinberger Slough. The recent studies looking at sediment transport and fate modeling and food web modeling in margin units show that focused implementation in priority areas can produce measurable environmental benefits. This PMU scale understanding is now central to our PCB-TMDL revision implementation strategy. San Leandro Bay provides one of the clearest examples of how PCB's recovery works at the PMU scale. San Leandro Bay is a highly retentive system, meaning that most sediment-bound PCBs that enter San Leandro Bay remain within the system. This also means recovery is driven by local conditions and local actions, not by dilution or flushing from the bay. So the PMU scale modeling in San Leandro Bay confirms that stormwater inputs control the pace of recovery. This point is illustrated in the figure on the right. The different lines on the graph show projected PCBs concentrations in San Leandro Bay sediments over time under a scenario where watershed tributary sources are cleaned up or overall source concentrations are reduced by half. The downward trend in the lines represents gradual recovery of San Leandro Bay as cleaner sediment covers and dilutes contaminated sediments. For example, the bottom purple line reflects a scenario with clean San Leandro Creek and shows one of the fastest recovery rates. This is because San Leandro Creek is the largest source of sediment to San Leandro Bay. So reducing PCB's concentrations in that sediment significantly affects the overall recovery. The key takeaway is that if we turn off the tap of PCBs, a recovery of San Leandro Bay sediments is achievable over the coming decades. In addition, when the food web dynamics are simulated in a simple model that tracks concentrations of PCBs up through the food chain, we see that when surface sediment concentrations are reduced, fish responds within similar timeframes. These findings directly inform the focus of the TMDR revision, which is to turn off the tap of PCBs from tributary watersheds. In addition, the revision will incorporate PMU scale, dialed up implementation actions into existing tools to accelerate measurable progress. We are approaching the end of the original 20-year implementation horizon established in the TMDL 2010. It is clear that this timeline for achieving stormwater wasteload allocations will not be met. The TMDL anticipated that achieving allocations would be challenging and allowed schedule adjustments only upon a robust demonstration of diligent source identification and load quantification, full implementation of all technically and economically feasible control measures, a showing that additional time is necessary despite those efforts, and a forward-looking plan to evaluate and implement additional controls. The TMDR revision will incorporate updated scientific information developed since 2010, including improved source characterization, updated loading analyses, PMU scale studies, monitoring data, and recent modeling efforts. The purpose of the updated analysis is to provide the justification to extend the timeline for achieving allocations, to support a revised implementation schedule, and to help identify the most effective actions to accelerate recovery. We are not anticipating to revise the TMDL targets and allocations. With that, I will turn it over to Katie, who will present our PCB's cleanup efforts.
Good morning. I'm going to highlight some of the efforts we've taken across the Regional Water Board over the last few years to shift towards a more integrated and coordinated approach to TMDL implementation, and I'll also provide an update on our efforts to address PCBs at cleanup sites. Our office has a PCBs team made up of staff from all of our programs. Since the team was created, we've increased the frequency of internal coordination meetings to ensure that staff working in different programs have opportunities to collaborate and learn from each other. We've also increased our coordination efforts with our external partners. The fact sheet shown on the slide is an example of our external outreach. We created this fact sheet in 2025 to educate people about the source property referral program being implemented by the permittees of the Municipal Regional Stormwater Permit, or MRP. This fact sheet has been distributed to consultants, property owners, and local stormwater agencies to help them better understand the purpose of the source property referral program and the steps that we typically take. The fact sheet is available on our PCB's TMDL website. I'll discuss the source property referral program in more detail later. We also created an email inbox that all members of the PCB's team have access to. This inbox serves as a single point of contact for reporting spills that involve PCBs, source property referrals, and general inquiries, and improves the team's ability to track all of these items. As our understanding of the number and extent of PCB sources has improved, it has become clear that no single agency or program can independently address PCBs contamination. To accelerate recovery of the bay, all of the programs must work together. For our Water Board staff, this has meant shared prioritization of hotspots and source areas, coordinating to investigate and clean up potential source properties, and collaborating on implementing and updating stormwater permits. We are also working more closely with our external partners for other regulatory agencies, such as our sister agency, the Department of Toxic Substances Control, the US EPA, and local county cleanup programs. We've worked to educate the cleanup staff about the TMDL and how cleanup actions can directly support watershed load reduction objectives. Water Board cleanup staff also meet once a month with their EPA, US EPA counterparts to discuss challenges and successes on PCB's cleanup projects. And staff from the Water Board cleanup program have also been meeting regularly with county stormwater agencies, and were recently invited to present to the Bay Area Municipal Stormwater Collaborative to provide information about the site investigation and cleanup process. MRP permittees, in collaboration with the Regional Monitoring Program, or RMP, have collected over 2,000 stormwater and sediment samples over the last few decades. The RMP is a multi-agency program that supports water quality data collection and modeling efforts in the San Francisco Bay. PCB's sampling is focused in old industrial areas, shown in red on the map, which are areas where PCBs were most likely to have been used and discharged prior to 1980. These sampling efforts have substantially improved our understanding of where PCBs contamination is concentrated. The data has directly informed our stormwater permit implementation efforts, PMU prioritization, source property identification, and development of our strategy for the upcoming TMDL revision. After a potential source property has been referred to the Water Board, staff in the site cleanup program require property owners to conduct investigations to confirm the presence of PCBs. Over the last decade, approximately 30 source properties have been referred to the Water Board for further investigation. The figure on this slide is from GeoTracker, our public database for cleanup sites. The dots represent sites where PCBs have been identified, and the different colors distinguish the different types of cleanup sites. To date, staff in the site cleanup program have overseen the investigation of PCBs contamination at 38 upland sites and 26 in-bay sites. Cleanup is complete or in progress at a majority of those sites, and the design of a cleanup strategy is in progress at many others. Note that this list of sites includes source properties that are referred to us, as well as sites that came to us through redevelopment, spill notifications, or other means. You might notice that there are 8 inactive in-bay sites. These primarily are the known toxic hotspots, which are not always tied to a specific source of contamination or a property owner who can be held responsible for cleanup. Addressing the toxic hotspots has been one of the biggest hurdles in restoring water quality in the bay. These 11 toxic hotspots shown on the map were identified by the Bay Protection and Toxic Cleanup Program in a 1999 statewide report. In 2023, staff in our NPDES program issued a Water Code Section 13383 order to the City and County of San Francisco to address 2 of the toxic hotspots, Mission and Islas Creeks in San Francisco. The order requires San Francisco to investigate water quality impairments in Mission and Islas Creeks and to propose actions to resolve the impairments. These creeks illustrate the challenges associated with legacy contamination in highly urbanized tidal systems, where multiple historical sources and ongoing watershed inputs may contribute to impairment. They also demonstrate the need for regulatory tools beyond traditional stormwater permits or cleanup and abatement orders to address persistent PCBs impacts. Some of you may recall our last PCBs cleanup update in 2021. In that presentation, we mentioned a cleanup and abatement order that was in progress for the Arroyo Viejo Creek Channel in Oakland, just upstream of San Leandro Bay. That order was issued in 2022, and since then, the responsible parties have been taking steps to fully characterize the site so that they can develop a robust remedial alternative. The upland properties adjacent to the creek are contaminated with PCBs and have historically been regulated by US EPA and the Department of Toxic Substances Control. Those agencies came to us to regulate the creek cleanup under our Water Code Authority. The colored dots on the figure on the slide represent just a portion of the data that's been collected at hundreds of locations and depth intervals. This figure shows the samples collected along the upper bank portions of the creek channel. The red and orange dots represent samples with elevated concentrations of PCBs that will most likely be removed, and the blue and green dots represent samples with lower concentrations of PCBs. The highest measured PCBs concentrations in the banks is 261 parts per billion, and the average in the shallow soil is about 1,000 parts per billion. Due to the work being conducted in water, there's a limited window of time during the dry season that sampling and remediation can occur. The data is being used to prepare a remedial design, which we expect to receive and improve this year. This cleanup will also need to account for habitat and watershed restoration requirements. Once this cleanup is complete, a significant amount of PCBs contaminated sediment will be removed, and we hope to see improvements in sediment and water quality in San Leandro Bay. Despite all the efforts we described today, PCBs remain a significant water quality problem in the Bay. We have learned a lot from 20 years of implementing the TMDL, and we'll continue to adjust our strategy to accelerate the Bay's recovery so that everyone who lives here, including myself, can continue to enjoy safely catching and eating seafood from the Bay. Seth and I are happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the board, see if there are any comments or questions. Board Member Gunther.
I have a lot of questions about this, and you can tell me to stop, and we maybe could do this. I mean, because of my involvement in doing the work that led to the TMDL and everything, so I'm just fascinated by this, and I do not need to drag my fellow board members through this.
Well, let's ask Eileen, because we do have 2 other...
Right. So I was going to say what we may want to do, depending on the pleasure of the board, is let our 2 other speakers talk, and then, Dr. Gunther, you can ask your questions, because maybe some of the questions might be answered by our 2 other speakers.
Yeah. Unless, and I always stop just in case there's something that people don't want to lose their thoughts on. Everyone okay? All right. Then we'll continue.
Great. Then up next will be Dr. Lisa Sabin, yes. Managing Scientist at EOA, and she will present the MERP permittee PCB update on behalf of the Bay Area Municipal Stormwater Collaborative. And then that will be followed by Rob Corson.
Thanks, Wes.
All right. Good morning, Water Board members and staff. I'm Lisa Sabin, a managing scientist at EOA. I'm presenting on behalf of the Phase 1 Municipal Stormwater Permittees and Programs. These are the cities, counties, and public agencies covered by the Municipal Regional Permit, or MRP. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. So I want to start by acknowledging the many collaborators working together and supporting the work that is being done by the permittees to reduce PCBs in stormwater. In particular, I want to note the importance of recent grants from the US EPA to both the BAMC agencies and the Regional Monitoring Program. This funding is critical to the work that needs to be done to achieve the PCBs TMDL. So we've heard about PCB issues from regional water board staff, but I want to add some additional context. So first, PCBs are a forever chemical and had many industrial and commercial uses in the past. So even though it's been nearly 50 years since they've been banned, slow releases from source properties and ongoing usage continue today. And it's important to point out that although the municipalities did not create the problem, they have invested substantial public resources to reduce PCBs in stormwater. We estimate the municipalities have spent over $100 million in public funds since the start of the PCBs TMDL. These resources have supported many successes. For example, we understand better now where PCBs are in our watersheds and which controls are most effective at reducing PCBs in stormwater. So we're making progress and we're focused in the right direction. However, the work is very challenging and more time is needed to achieve the TMDL goals. The urban runoff requirements of the PCBs TMDL are implemented through provisions of the Municipal Regional Permit, or MRP. These requirements were developed with a phased approach, building upon each other. MRP 1 focused on monitoring and pilot testing controls in a few specific locations. MRP 2 focused on monitoring in old industrial areas to identify source properties and development of additional control programs like the building demolition program. MRP 3 is focused on wider implementation of controls across the larger old industrial areas and includes controls such as investigations on private properties, implementing controls on private properties, as well as potential stormwater treatment downstream and enhanced operation and maintenance actions to remove PCB-bound sediment from streets and storm drain structures. So Katie just showed you the figure on the right. This represents over 20 years of BAMC agencies and the RMP monitoring data. We've collected over 2,500 stormwater and sediment samples. And I want to emphasize the vast majority of those were collected by the municipalities. These data clearly show us that PCBs are more concentrated in older industrial areas, which are shown on the map on the left. Due to historic land use trends, old industrial areas are found mostly around the bay margins. and many of these areas drain directly to the bay rather than being conveyed through the MS4. These areas also tend to overlap with disadvantaged communities. And although we know PCBs are more concentrated in old industrial areas, not all old industrial areas are created equal. This figure shows the results of over 1,800 sediment samples that were collected in public rights of way in old industrial areas. You can see there's a wide range of PCB concentrations spanning multiple orders of magnitude. The MRP identified action thresholds. Oh, dear. Sorry, my tablet just died. Okay, I'm back. Nope. Apologies.
Don't worry, those pesky technical difficulties.
Move that, maybe yes. Okay, so the MRP identifies action thresholds, which are, which are shown on this figure. So these help us identify where to focus controls. I also want to note two important points about these data. First, the majority of samples collected in old industrial areas do not have elevated PCBs, as you can see from all of the samples that are in the green zone. And second, the majority of samples that are above our action thresholds are located in catchments with known PCB source properties. This figure compares the right-of-way data in old industrial areas that I just showed you with PCB concentrations in shallow surface soils on source properties. And this figure really illustrates why it is so important to find and abate source properties, because this is where we find the really high PCBs. Also, PCBs migrating into the public right-of-way are likely from these source properties. So by abating these source properties, we can effectively turn off the tap. So over the past 15 years, permittees have developed a robust control measure toolbox to address PCBs in stormwater. There are two main buckets in this toolbox. The first bucket on the left includes controls that are specifically targeted to areas with elevated PCBs. These are the focus controls that we're implementing in our older industrial areas. The second bucket on the right are the programmatic controls. These controls are mostly opportunistic, meaning that the permittees don't control the timing or location of these activities, but when they do happen, they can provide meaningful load reduction benefits. And then the controls on the bottom of the slide span both buckets, because although they're primarily implemented for reasons other than PCBs, they can provide PCB load reduction benefits, and in some cases can even be targeted to areas with elevated PCBs. So I want to talk a little bit more about the focused controls. These are in areas with elevated PCBs, and these controls all start with investigations in our old industrial areas. First, we conduct monitoring in the public right-of-way. If PCBs are elevated, the next step is to conduct inspections and sampling on adjacent properties. Properties with high PCBs are confirmed source properties that require referral to the Water Board for abatement. Properties with moderate PCBs are addressed locally, with the municipality working directly with the property owners to implement BMPs on the property. And then for elevated PCBs in the public right-of-way, municipalities are also implementing controls, which can include actions to remove PCB-laden sediments from street and storm drain infrastructure, may even include installation of treatment systems downstream, especially where other options are limited. So across the MRP area, there are about 40,000 acres of old industrial areas, which varies by county. Over the past 15 years, more than half of these areas have already been investigated. And we've learned a lot from these investigations. For example, investigations are an iterative process that can take 2 to 3 rounds of sampling to identify sources. So they're very labor intensive and they take a lot of time. Also, conducting sampling on private properties has its own unique challenges. But despite all the considerable efforts that have been made to date, we've currently identified a relatively small amount of moderate or high PCB areas. So unlike focus controls, the programmatic controls are implemented across the larger watershed area. The program to manage PCBs during building demolition is focused. It's focused on using municipal permitting authority to provide demolition permits. And the demolition contractors are required to test materials for PCBs. And if PCBs are found at concentrations above 50 parts per million, then they have to ensure that they're doing proper removal and disposal of those materials to ensure that PCBs are not released to the environment during demolition. So the permittees have been implementing this program since 2019, and BAMSI is currently conducting an effectiveness evaluation with 7 years of data. The program to manage PCBs and electrical utility equipment is primarily focused on tracking and documenting the removal of PCB-containing electrical equipment from active service. This program, however, is currently limited to municipally owned electrical utilities. But the vast majority of electrical equipment in the Bay Area belongs to PG&E. So load reductions through this program are primarily dependent on PG&E actions. Regional Water Board staff are currently in talks with PG&E about their plans to remove their remaining PCB-containing electrical equipment. And then finally, the program to control PCBs during bridge demolition is still under development in collaboration with Caltrans. So more to come on this one. But essentially, it's the same idea as the building demolition program to ensure proper testing, removal, and disposal of PCB-containing caulking on bridges prior to demolition. So in addition to the control measure implementation permittees have been doing, they've also developed TMDL implementation plans. These plans identify the control measures, levels of implementation, and timelines to achieve the PCB's TMDL waste load allocations for stormwater. The combined results are shown here in the pie chart, which provides the relative load reductions by control measure that will achieve the TMDL waste load allocations for stormwater from the 5 MRP area counties. And notice that the top 3 controls achieve 80% of the required PCB load reductions. These controls include source property identification and abatement, private redevelopment with green stormwater infrastructure, and managing PCBs during building demolition. Of these, source property identification and abatement is the only control where permittees and regulatory agencies can set the pace and level of implementation. The other two controls are mostly opportunistic and depend primarily on private redevelopment. Also note that focus controls implemented in moderate PCB areas provide relatively small benefits. So in summary, the stormwater programs can't work alone. We need water board and EPA support and funding, and at times we need these agencies to take the lead to fully address the problem. We appreciate water board staff's willingness to partner with cities and counties on source property investigation and cleanups. As I mentioned earlier, we estimate over $100 million has been spent to date by phase one MRP permittees on investigations and control programs to reduce PCBs in stormwater. This is a big price tag for local agencies to address this legacy pollutant, especially with the limited ability to generate local funding. We appreciate US EPA Region 9's help with funding. We couldn't have made the progress to date without the grant funding provided by EPA. However, grants are short-term and don't support long-term implementation of control measure programs. Substantial progress has been made to date through implementation of the control programs outlined in my presentation. Additional information on estimated PCB load reductions by all of the phase one stormwater programs will be submitted in annual reports to the Water Board later this year. We believe that we've identified the optimal set of controls that will allow the PCB's urban stormwater waste load allocations to be achieved. That said, implementation of these controls will take time. And it's partially dependent on work completed by private property owners on their old industrial properties. We appreciate the opportunity to check in with you on this important subject and share the work that local cities and counties have conducted to date. And we look forward to continuing this dialogue with you as the MRP is reissued later next year and when the PCB's TMDL is considered over the next few years. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Sabin. And I think that leads us, Eileen, to our last commentator.
Yeah, it might be best to, if I'm looking at Dr. Gunther, who I know has some questions. Do you want to proceed to the third speaker? Or do you want to ask?
We have one more speaker.
One question now. The one question I have now is that when we're thinking about our priority margin units, the problem is a mass load movement from the watershed down to the margin. So as we seem to be making enormous progress at identifying where in these watershed areas we have PCBs residing. Yeah. And if I remember correctly, the identification is the easy part compared to the removal. But in the meantime, we know these contaminated sediments are there, and I would imagine they are in a variety of degrees of stability. And I'm wondering if as we identify them, are we also taking intermediate steps? And this maybe goes back to Jane's question about the coming Super El Nino. Are we taking intermediate steps to ensure that the PCBs stay there, even if it rains really hard, before we get to finding the money to actually removing them?
The answer is yes, in most cases. Any properties that are submitted as referrals to the Water Board also have a component of developing an enhanced O&M plan.
Good. Okay.
In the vicinity of the property, mm-hmm. with exactly that idea in mind, to contain the PCBs on the site or remove what's already in the public right-of-way while the property is being Great. Abated.
Any other questions for the board before we move forward? No? Okay. Eileen?
Oh, thank you. And next, we're going to have Rob Carson, the Stormwater Program Administrator for the Marin County-wide Stormwater Pollution Prevention Program, speak on behalf of the Phase 2 permittees. Thank you.
Excellent. Good morning. As she said, I'm Rob Carson, Program Administrator for the Marin County-wide Pollution Prevention Program. I have the privilege of providing this presentation to your board regarding the PCB TMDL update from the Phase 2 permittee perspective. So just to set the stage on who we are. So the Phase 2 small MS4 permit regulates the smaller communities in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Water Regional Board's jurisdiction, many of which are located in the more rural parts of the Bay Area, largely in Marin, Napa, Sonoma, and Solano counties. The inset map there shows the Phase 2 county boundaries, but doesn't show the Phase 2 areas of San Francisco or the non-traditional permittees, including ports, transit agencies, and universities, among others, that are distributed throughout Region 2's jurisdictional boundary. The Phase 2 areas include 26 traditional permittees, cities, towns, and counties, and flood districts, and 23 non-traditional permittees. There we go. So the Phase 2 communities are currently under the statewide small MS4 permit that was issued in 2013. Permit reissuance is underway. In fact, within the month, we expect to see the public comment draft of that permit released. The current order does not include any provisions to implement the PCB TMDL, but I have it under good authority that we anticipate PCB controls will be included in the reissued permit. And in fact, this underlines the point that the Phase 2 permittees have not had the 15-year history of monitoring and pilot projects that the MRP permittees have undertaken. However, the foundational work that they have done will inform development of the Phase 2 control programs. That said, the Phase 2 communities have implemented measures during the past 10 to 15 years that, taken together, are expected to reduce loading to the bay and to increase our understanding of sources, pathways, and loadings. These include the low-impact development or green stormwater infrastructure, stormwater treatment for new and redevelopment, which has been implemented at the 5,000-square-foot level since 2015. So for the last 11 years in the Phase 2 communities, we've been implementing those. And just to highlight back to Lisa's presentation, that those GSI retrofits were responsible for almost over 20% of the reductions that they observed. So we would expect to see some benefit from that in the Phase 2 communities as well. Also, some of the Phase 2 communities, including those in Marin, have provided ongoing annual support to SFEI's regional monitoring program that have characterized PCBs in the Bay and in the tributary watersheds. So as I said, we've been in discussions with the Regional Water Board regarding the PCB TMDL since 2020. And to the extent allowed by our resources and our governing bodies, we've proactively started planning to understand what addressing PCBs in our communities and watersheds will require. So in addition to that, well, actually I'll jump forward. So putting back up this figure that was in the Water Board's presentation, available data shows much lower concentrations in the bay downstream of North Bay Phase 2 communities. With a more diffuse nature of the PCBs at lower concentrations, there's little low-hanging fruit and more work to investigate and control those sources. So this slide has a couple of tables. The top right shows you the regional watershed spreadsheet model PCB yield from different land uses, and the table on the bottom is just an example of a preliminary evaluation of those land use types in Marin. So as you can see from that, we have very few source properties. We have no old industrial areas, and we have very large areas of old commercial and old transportation. So without the high PCB yield areas, the BMPs and control programs will be much less effective in the phase two communities for the same level of effort. So with no changes to anticipated load reductions in the TMDL update, phase two permittees will need generous timelines to find and then reduce those load sources. So recognizing that work would be needed to control PCBs and the efficiencies of working together and learning from MRP permittees, a group of the phase two permittees joined the effort to acquire PCB's TMDL Special Studies and Implementation Project grant from the EPA. There are seven phase two partners shown in this map that are involved in that project to develop control programs to reduce PCB loads to the bay. And because we haven't seen the actual TMDL language in our reissued permit, we're developing those programs based on anticipated program and permit requirements, scaled from similar programs under the MRP. So just to reiterate, many of the same control programs, in fact, all of them really will be implemented under the phase two permit as well, including development of green stormwater infrastructure plans, implementing the building material and waste PCB control program, as well as those for controlling PCBs from bridges and overpasses, identifying source properties where they can be identified, implementing, obviously, PCB collection programs, water quality monitoring, fish consumption risk reduction outreach, and then, of course, the regional load reduction accounting framework that's necessary to show our progress to reduce those loads. But because, again, the phase two permit hasn't been reissued, the early tasks that we're undertaking under this grant are based on more certain permit requirements like the green stormwater infrastructure planning efforts. So to summarize, you know, the phase two communities are on the same path, but, you know, about 15 years behind the MRP permittees on these efforts. We anticipate different challenges and fewer concentrated areas to focus on. The control programs and load reductions will take significant resources and time to realize the outcomes that we're all looking for. We are very appreciative, as Lisa said, of the both the EPA grant funding and for the phase two perspective, the regional program development that the MRP permittees have undertaken over the last 10 or 15 years. So with that, I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Rob. I'm going to bring it back to the board for any open questions. Anyone?
I'm going to maybe show my ignorance here, but I just like a little, maybe staff can help me understand this. Sounds like we've been working on implementing this for a long period of time, and different communities face different issues now. Some have areas where they can really go after things because there are still big industrial facilities that they can pursue, while others it's more diffuse situation. And anyway, could you just help break down for me, like, how has the regulatory community, the community that's being regulated, how has their profile changed over the years? Is it different? Like, is what San Francisco is facing or the East Bay is facing different than what Marin is facing? Has it changed throughout the region, or is it still one big pot?
So Board Member Betty, what we're describing here and what's described in the TMDL is an effort over time to frame where sources are in the Bay Area and you know, the relative priority of those sources, and then how do we add up control actions that will then contribute to, for urban runoff, that 90% reduction and ultimately hopefully get the Bay back to, you know, sort of edible fish for PCBs, for like shiner surf perch. That picture has become clearer over time. But the PCBs that were discharged, you know, were discharged until the late 1970s, or even, you know, more recently with ongoing, as we talked about, you know, PCBs in soil are associated with building demolition. So the picture is relatively static. It's informed by ongoing monitoring. But, and as you just heard from Rob Carson, who I
by the way, just want to thank for being such an organizing force and doing proactive work on these kinds of things with the small and non-traditional stormwater communities. As you heard from him, there aren't quite as many sources in those North Bay communities as compared to some of the historic industrial lands that we have in the Central, East, and South Bays. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but the...
I think you are. I guess what I'm thinking about on the next phase of this regulatory action, will we change how we think about what prescriptions are needed for what different profiles? Or maybe we won't, but I'm just...
Well, you'll hear more about this as staff works on the planned sort of update to the PCB's TMDL, but Set and I has provided a brief sort of preview of some of the changed areas of focus, including particularly priority margin units right. like San Leandro Bay.
Okay, thanks. I'll wait to learn more.
Thank you. Anyone else on the board? I think everyone has kind of had their questions answered. Let's see here. Julie, do we have any members of the public that would like to comment on this item?
No one's registered online.
And do we have any Zoom participants waiting to speak?
No.
And last but not least, is there anyone in the room who would like to comment? Oh, everyone's all excited about PCBs. Okay. With that, then I think that I'll close that. So thank you all. The board will now be meeting in closed session for agenda item 12 to discuss whether to initiate litigation and item 12B, discuss pending litigation. All recordings and the live webcast will be stopped, and the board members will reconvene on the 15th floor in conference room 1505. We will return to the auditorium in about an hour to adjourn the meeting. Of course, turn on the microphone. This concludes the public session of the June 10th, 2026 San Francisco Bay Water Board meeting. Thank you all for joining us today. We appreciate your engagement. Our next meeting is scheduled for August 12th, 2026, starting at 9 a.m. here in the first floor auditorium of the Elihu Harris Building, 1515 Clay Street, Oakland. Bang the gavel. Have a good month, everybody.